ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And welcome back with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen on the respective socials. You can find him at Matt Allen FNP. Crack a smile. We're looking forward to a big time card. We have Armin Tsarukyan taking on Mateusz Gamrot. Matt, listen, when we're in the doldrums of the 12-month calendar year, sometimes we're trying to get ourselves excited for Miesha Tate versus Ketlin Vieira as the main event, or Holly Holm versus Ketlin Vieira as the main event. And if Mick Maynard and Sean Shelby said, Craig, Matt, you guys get to throw down your ballot, you get to cast your secret vote for a main event, don't you think we go with something squirrely like Tsarukyan versus Gamrot?
It does make a lot of sense, and it does seem like it was picked by us over here at Fight Night Picks, but this card's been really good, and honestly, the past few Fight Night cards have been pretty stacked top to bottom, and I really like what the UFC's been doing. I didn't think I was going to bring this up. Just give everybody who gets a finish a bonus, because I don't know if you've noticed this, a lot of recent Fight Night cards have been littered full of finishes, so how about we just reward every single athlete who goes out there and is able to get a knockout or a submission? Hopefully they keep on doing that, because that's been really cool, and I think we're going to do a lot more finishes on this card too. Just to pick out a few fights just from up and down this card, I'm way more excited for Hallie and Paiva versus Sergey Morozov than I thought I would be. Morozov was in an absolute war his last time out with a much tinier version of like a 2012 Vitor Belfort in Silva de Andrade, so you know he's going to be looking to kind of build himself back up against a guy like Hallie and Paiva, who, if you just look at his wins and losses in the UFC, you might not be all that impressed, but if you actually watch each and every one of those fights, they are always exciting, so I think that's going to be an incredible fight.
So many great fights up and down this card, and of course there's 12 of them. We'll see if maybe they decide to softball Donald Cerrone and Joe Lozano on
this. He unlocked his knee. He can walk now.
Please, goodness me, no. But there are four ranked fighters on this card. Main event, co-main event. We'll throw it on over to our fight of the night screen, and as it says on that poster that's over there next to the mat, comment below. Let us know some of your picks. Toss a like and a sub if you haven't already. We'll get that jazz out of the way. We'll throw it on over to the fight of the night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
When we're talking fight of the nights, listen, we hate to do it with Fight Night Picks. We hate the cherry pick, but we're going to start by cherry picking. Last weekend, Calvin Kattar and Josh Emmett, that was a fight of the night. It was such a close fight, ended up as a split decision. This fight in the co-main event slot, Neil Magny, since he debuted in the UFC in 2013, has a whopping ridiculous 19-7 record overall. His last number of fights, majority of them wins over some legends of the sport. Obviously, that Robbie Lawler one's a pretty nice feather to have in your cap, but he's taking on a phenom in the 15-0 Kazakhstan fighter known as Shavkat Rakhmonov. And for Nomad, 3-0 in the UFC, all three of them by finish, taking on a battle-tested actual veteran in Neil Magny out of Elevation. I love this fight on paper. I think Neil Magny is one of those guys that could pose a couple of interesting wrinkles to a guy like Rakhmonov. But Matt, I know we're super excited about this one.
I love Neil Magny as an opponent for a bright prospect because he's so well-rounded. No matter what you do, he's going to be able to do at least something that's the opposite of it. And he'll be able to find one hole in your game. And that's why I do think Neil Magny is the perfect gatekeeper for this division. Right now, he does kind of find himself in that Derek Brunson, kind of Alexander Volkov role. But for Magny, we know how good he looks on his best day. You bring up the Robbie Lawler win. I go all the way back to Kelvin Gastelum on The Ultimate Fighter. Like, that was a really long time ago now that you think about it. But that's the thing about Magny. He's been so active that we do have a pretty good idea as to his strengths and his weaknesses. So for a guy like Shavkat Rakhmonov, who, you look at his record, 15-0, 8 knockouts, 7 submissions. Like, it is almost too good to be true. And a guy like Neil Magny with his grimy style is probably going to tell us something about Shavkat Rakhmonov that we don't already know.
I mean, Matt, no cuts here with Fight Night Picks for this one. You cherry pick off the top. But I mean, Armin Tsarukyan taking on Mateusz Gamrot. You look at these guys skill for skill, and they match up and line up so well. I mean, you focus on it for Gamrot, a wrestling base to go along with a grappling ADCC European champion many times over, as recently as 2019 as well. Former KSW featherweight champ, lightweight champ. He's been in 6 title fights, plus 2 fights against Norman Park, where Park didn't make the weight, and they should have been title fights. But they were awesome fights. And for Gamrot, he has that championship experience. If you look at it for Tsarukyan, former champion with a smaller organization, 3-round fights there, winning decisions. But you look at this, his first opportunity at a main event, That's five rounds, period. And for Zarukian, fight of the night in his debut against Islam Makhachev, first person to actually take him down successfully. Since then, he has been absolutely amazing. Beating wrestlers at their craft like Matt Frivola, beating strikers at their game. Armin Tsarukian's riding a wave of fan favoritism. I'm really looking forward to this fight.
What I love about the main event and the co-main event, what this whole event should be called, is UFC Spotlight. Because Armin Tsarukian, Mateusz Gamrot, and Shavkat Rakhmonov, they're not nearly as well known as their skill sets would suggest. If you just talk about the skills of this sport and not the personalities and what people talk about, I would argue these are three of the most skilled guys across the board. It just, that's not really how it works. People care about your personalities and your fighting style. I just really hope that this weekend, all three of these fighters, Neil Magny included, don't forget about him, it's just he's been around for a long time at this point. I just hope these three fighters really get the spotlight they deserve, because win, lose, or draw for Mateusz Gamrot and for Armin Tsarukian, I think they have proved up until this point that they deserve to be fighting guys in the top 15 and pretty much no one else, because it's almost criminal what happens to unranked fighters when they fight either one of these guys. So hopefully, no matter what happens as a result of this main event, both guys can just maintain this sort of, maybe not main event caliber, but you get the idea. They can stay in the rankings, they don't just become that 14th the 15th ranked guy, who they'll be in the rankings 1 week and outside the next week. So I think this is a great main event.
Spotlight, yeah. Moonlight, yeah. FNP hoping for a good week, yeah. We have a big time slate of cards, 12 of them, 12 fights on the card coming up, and I can't wait for it. Those two fight of the night picks are ours, but you let us know down below. I know one that I have earmarked, Mario Bautista taking on Brian Kelleher at 135. Should be an amazing one as well. And there are a lot of great ones on this card. So when it comes to this card overall, I had a peek at the odds pre-fight. There's six people on this card that are more than a 2-1 favorite. So some bigger favorites as we had last weekend. But you know, favorites don't always come through. And sometimes some sneaky debuts are sneaky. Natalia Silva, I'm looking at you. Looked like a completely different fighter.
She really did. And some people do listen to what we say, because I told anyone who would listen, I think Kevin Holland's going to submit Tim Means. And a few people out there took my advice, and guess what happened?
The Darce Knight. It goes from Kyle Daukaus to Kevin Holland.
I've got to be honest, this is off script, but I'm so excited for Kevin Holland at 170. Like, I really do think he's proven that he's a similar fighter down there. So great performance by Holland.
Really making things happen. But on this card, the biggest favorite and one of the bigger favorites you're ever going to find in the UFC, Umar Nurmagomedov taking on Nate Maness, who's on a tidy 4-fight win streak. Another big guy making the comeback. Chris Curtis, 2021. Very generous to him, as was 2020. And for Curtis, looking to push a giant win streak forward, taking on one of the best grapplers in jiu-jitsu, period, in Adolfo Vieira, the black belt hunter. That should be an amazing fight. 12 on this card. We're so amped up for it. We can't wait. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend at strawweight. We have a couple of champs that were champs outside of the big show. And Virginia Frye, former Invicta atomweight champ, she went over to Ryzen. She tried to challenge for the belt, was unsuccessful, came back over to Invicta and made things happen. 2-2 in the UFC is Frye, and she's taking on the little monster, Vanessa Demopoulos, former LFA. Big time strawweight champ over there, and she wasn't able to get it done when she fought over with Dana White's Contender Series, a loss to Poppin. She goes back to the regional scene. Things play out the way that they play out, but always on the radar of the big promotion. Wasn't able to get the win against JJ Aldrich in her short notice UFC debut up weight class, but for Demopoulos, she was able to get knocked down and then dragged him out against Silvana Gomez Juarez in her last fight. So for Demopoulos, it's been an odd run. She's a fighter that's been on the fans' radar for a long time. Maybe she's a part of your Amazon book club, obviously the author of the Stripper Bible.
No one brings this up more than you.
But if you look at it, because I want to go into the readings of both fighters. For Demopoulos, that's the claim to fame. Virginia Frye,
I feel like the FBI with Pusha T lyrics right now. You're deep diving.
If you look at it, Virginia Frye, the background in nuclear medicine and radiological services, completely different book collection that they have going on at home. And when you look at their fight styles, similarities in some aspects and major differences in others. And the biggest thing that I wanted to hammer home on this one, Matt, I talk about it with Fight Night Picks. So I don't look at the odds. I don't look at the odds pre-fight. I clicked on Best Fight Odds before I even did anything with this fight. And I went, oh my God, I got to spit out my coffee. Ginyu Frye's a 3-1 favorite at open. What are we doing here? Like 2-2 in the UFC, negative strike differential, 37% takedown percentage, you know, for Virginia Frye. it's just odd that when I look at that and I look at a fighter that's 2-2, I really have to take some pause and then really deep dive into the tape study on this one for Fry to be justified as a 3-1 favorite in the spot.
Exactly, and that's something we talk about quite a bit. You do have to justify being that big of a favorite in really any of your fights, because it does seem like there's one of these fights every single weekend where you have two fighters, maybe on two fight losing streaks. You don't really know what's going to happen for the rest of their career, and all of a sudden they're matched up, and one's like a 3-1 favorite over the other, and this is pretty much that exact situation. I do think Fry's whole experience is going to play a factor in this fight, just because I do feel like she has fought the higher level of competition throughout her fight. And this is the thing about Jin Yu Fry. She's someone who came over who did have a number of losses on her way coming into the UFC. She didn't have this squeaky clean record. Like you said, she lost to Sohee Ham over in Road FC, actually. That was by TKO, too.
And the big one is, again, Sohee Ham, but Hamasaki a couple of different times, once with Invicta, but once with Ryzen as well. Like, those are like legends of the sport.
They
so
really are. But this is the other thing about Jin Yu Fry's career when you really want to break it down. Jin Yu Fry, excuse me. Mina Grusander wins are weighed far too heavily. Like,
a little stink bomb.
The Boxing Hall of Fame induction ceremony was last weekend. They did 3 induction classes all in one just because they weren't able to have it due to the pandemic. And, like, Roy Jones Jr., I listened to a bunch of his interviews because he got inducted. And he was saying, like, yeah, the reason I'm here is I beat James Toney. I beat Bernard Hopkins. They're also getting inducted into the Hall of Fame, and I made that look easy. Jin Yu Fry's not going to sit at her UFC induction ceremony for the Hall of Fame and be like, yeah, I took down Mina Grusander and Invicta. Show me my respect. I just feel like there's always been a certain level of hype for Fry coming into the UFC that we've never really seen justified once she came over here, because she was one of these 35-year-old prospects, if you will. I know even calling her a prospect is kind of weird because she was a champion on her way into the UFC, but just a newcomer, if you will, who was later on in her career. And it felt like she was seen as a potential threat, honestly, to the strawweight division, and then she had disappointing performance after disappointing performance, and I know she has been able to stabilize her career to a certain degree at this point, but her level of competition has not been overly high her last two fights, and that's why this one against Demopolis is still going to be a very much a learning experience, I think, for UFC fans for both these fighters.
Yeah, so for Jin Yu Fry, she's been an underdog in all 4 of her UFC fights, and now she's a minus 300 favorite. Again, the odds have shifted, minus 275 right now as we tape this video on Sunday night. When you're an underdog for 4 fights, you go out there, you lose to Kay Hansen, which is fine, I guess.
It's
mean, at the end of it, Hansen rallied, took her down, was able to get the submission. She loses to Loma Lookmanmi, who's well-rounded. I know she's known as a Muay Thai striker, but Loma will mix in the threat of the takedown, and it works great for her in her fight. So you look at those two ones, okay, you can scratch it. She beats Gloria De Paula, who laid an egg last weekend.
Turns out it's not that hard to do.
Maria Oliveira putting her to 6-5. So a win over Gloria De Paula, and then a win over Ashley Yoder last time out. She looked very good in that Yoder fight. For Yoder, she's kind of tricky in every aspect of MMA. But for Jin Yu Fry, what made it count was 1-2, 1-2, 1-2. Cross, and then left hook. Like, she's able to mix in a couple of things, but it was just 1-2 city. Very few leg kicks there from Fry. Very basic in it, but successful at what she's good at. Genesis BJJ is the home, and if you look at it, and I'll throw the picture up there, she's also mixed it up with 10th Planet, training with such figures as Luis J. Gomez, noted podcaster. So a lot of fun there for Jin Yu Fry. But again, Fortis MMA, Genesis BJJ. We've seen her train with Emily Ducati, who's now in the UFC, so that's a lot of fun. But I do look at it for Fry, again, much more polished when it comes to striking. We talked a lot about Fry. Let's talk about Vanessa Demopoulos, Matt, because I go through Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, training with Tabitha Ricci in Southern California, but also it's big that Demopoulos has switched her camp up to Fight Ready, and I see Tabitha Ricci in the last couple of weeks going over, traveling there to train with her. I think that's a perfect training partner in a fight against Fry, because Fry can threaten the takedown, big with the ground and pound. Yes, she does have submission abilities, but for Vanessa Demopoulos, wild as hell on the feet.
Not in a good way either.
No.
Not like in a Yair Rodriguez, wow, this is awesome.
We're dropping our hands. We're going to throw some kicks. We're going to throw some odd angle shots. We're going to go completely wild with the striking. And then when it comes to her grappling, odd when it comes to her takedowns, good off of her back, but you don't ever want to be on your back when you're grappling. Like I said that about Guram Khatatladze last weekend, and he was able to have some fun. He didn't have to fight off his back. But Demopoulos specializes off her back, and when you're losing fights to people like Sam Hughes to then get an inverted triangle with your legs, like, these aren't things that I talk about all that often. Demopoulos is a fighter that can do that. She can really accentuate how good and how tricky and slick she is with her grappling. But Matt, all this to say, a minus 300 favorite in a very close fight, I have a hard time with this one.
So do I. Again, I think this fight's really just Demopolis needs to take down, Fry needs to keep it on the feet, and it's almost as simple as that. I do think Fry can steal moments and maybe even a round in that top position, because Demopolis is susceptible to getting into those Louis Smolka positions where she can be held down, trying to go for a submission a little bit too much, but Demopolis' activity is really her key with her submission ability. She's very active on the feet and on the mat, and it normally does pay off in her fights. I just don't know if it's going to pay off against someone who is as experienced as Fry in these matchups, and I do think for Fry, early on in her UFC career, the physicality of these strawweights was a little bit too much for her, but the good thing is, Demopolis is about as small as someone at this division can be. It's not like she's fighting a Marina Rodriguez who would look like she's four divisions bigger than her. So I do think for Fry, she's fighting someone much closer to her own style. She is the physically stronger person in this fight, and I do think that she can steal some moments in that top position and on the feet. I do like Fry, so I'm not even worried about the odds because I couldn't imagine putting money on a fight like this, but I do think Junior Fry is the safer pick. And at the end of the week, we don't figure out what the odds are and then make our picks. We just see who's right and wrong on each and every one. So I do think Junior Fry is the more consistent fighter because I think she can win on the feet and on the ground, whereas I only think Demopolis can have success on the ground.
Fry open minus 300, minus 275. For Demopolis open, a plus 250, plus 220. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Fry.
I'll say under.
I'm gonna say, oh my goodness. 547 total votes, 74% Fry, 93% by decision for the 26% that have Demopolis, 57% by decision, 35% by submission. Listen, I mean, Bronco country, let's ride. I'm gonna go with Jinyu Fry in this one. It's an awkward one. Demopolis, though, again, she has a hard time figuring out range and distance when it comes to the striking. And when it comes to basic combinations, Jinyu Fry goes out there and looks like Russell Wilson throwing touchdowns. So for me, I'm going to go with Jinyu Fry as well. Again, not the most common to pick. When you're going with a minus 300 favorite Jinyu Fry against Vanessa Demopolis, if you're laying that chalk, you know, the spirit be with you, I guess. It's an awkward spot to be at.
I thought you were going
to
explode. You sounded like a volcano about to erupt. Yeah, I think Junior Fry is going to win. I hate the odds on this fight, though, because they don't make any sense whatsoever. Like, Demopolis could lose three fights in a row and be gone and no one would be surprised, and the same thing could happen for Junior Fry. Probably not the nicest way I could have broken down this fight, but that's kind of what my ending statement is going to be. I like Junior Fry just because, again, I do think she is the more well-rounded out of these two fighters, but if Demopolis can get in that top position on the ground, I do think she will be active enough to threaten with submissions.
I'm just trying to make it as awkward as Russ did. Let's ride.
I hate all that. Let's ride. Go Hawks.
Let's ride. Matt, let's ride. We've got Texas's own Jinyu Fry.
Future versus Russell Wilson. Who you got? Future without a doubt.
Future all day. Matt, big time fight coming up this weekend and in the main event. Holy smokes. Armin Tsarukyan taking on Mateusz Gamrot. Can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, a bantamweight banger that absolutely would have fit into last weekend's lineup with the eight finishes on that card. Holy smokes, how great was that? We have Brian Kelleher, the nickname's Boom. He's taking on Mario Bautista of No Fixed Nickname. And when I look at this fight, Matt, these guys are so well matched. I mean, for Mario Bautista, comes into the UFC making his debut against Corey Sandhagen, and he landed some good shots in that fight. I mean, he landed some nice leg kicks. He landed that overhand right that he has. And of course, he goes for a takedown, and he gets reversed, and he gets caught in an armbar. So he loses that fight, and that's fine. I mean, for Bautista, it's been weird. I mean, he's had some injuries. He's had some layoffs. He had a torn right pec that kind of kept him away from the Trevin Jones fight till he fought Jay Perrin, or rather, the Miles Johns fight until he fought Trevin Jones. But if you look at it, that's it. Fights about once a year, wants to get moving. I read his UFC.com interview that he had done before his last fight, which wasn't supposed to be Jay Perrin, but ended up as Jay Perrin, and he wanted to get the ball rolling. Well, good news for him, second fight of this year, and you like to see that because for Bautista, after he lost to Corey Sandhagen, went out there, fought Jinsu Sun, a guy who was always a lot of fun
in
his two UFC fights, and Bautista went out there, mixed it up, had great strikes, had some good moments when it came to his grappling, goes out there and fights Miles Johns. And listen, Mario Bautista, you know what you're going to get out of his fights because he's going to throw good boxing combinations while moving forward. He's going to end things with a kick or start things with a kick. He's a lot of fun when it comes to those flowing combinations. But for Bautista, He's no stranger to, I'm going to throw a flying knee, and if it hits you, it hits you. If it doesn't hit you, I'm going to throw more of them. He did that against Perrin. He's done that in the majority of his fights. Spinning attacks, flying knees. If you liked Ricardo Ramos last week, you like a guy like Bautista. He loses to Trevin Jones, which, when that guy's on, he's on. But when he's off, boy, he's off. And then for Bautista's last time out, takes on Jay Perrin. And in that fight, he was originally supposed to be taking on Khalid Taha. Perrin is a gamer. Perrin takes the fight out of New England. And Matt, it was pretty much all Bautista in that fight. So we didn't necessarily learn a lot, but it was a good opportunity for Bautista to get fresh, get a fight in. And now he's going to be taking on Brian Kelleher, a guy who was battle-tested if it's never been said.
I really liked how Mario Bautista looked in that Jay Perrin fight, and I understand that was a fight he was kind of expected to win going into it, but still, coming off a TKO loss to a guy like Trevin Jones, you never really know where somebody's going to be after that. So I just thought that was a great performance to kind of get that rust off him, if you know what I mean. Just get a good win under his belt. And this fight against Brian Kelleher could get him back on track to maybe not getting a ranked opponent next, but someone near the rankings, because Kelleher is an extremely well-respected fighter in this division, and even though he hasn't beaten all the best guys in the division, he's definitely fought them at this point of his career.
Now hold on, does he have a win on his record over the best bantamweight of all time?
He does. Henan Barao crumbled under the power of Brian Kelleher, but you have to remember he also fought John Lineker back at like UFC 223, and if you know anything about John Lineker, that man comes to crack, and he did knock out John Lineker, or he did knock out Brian Kelleher very bad.
John Lineker, a guy who lost by split decision to Corey Sandhagen, and the UFC said, see you later, we don't need any more of this.
It was wild, and I love John Lineker. Hands of Stone, nicknamed after Roberto Duran. I think this fight will be very fun, though, because I do think Mario Bautista has the higher ceiling, I would say, out of these two athletes. Even Brian Kelleher, on his best day, is still somewhat basic with the way he goes about his fighting. It is a lot of, I would say, basic boxing combinations. He doesn't go to the body as much as you'd probably like. A bit of a headhunter. Has good but not great power, I would say. Can clip you if you're on your way in and not really watching yourself defensively. But for the most part, Brian Kelleher is not the type of fighter who you think, wow, he's going to go in there and drop the guy with one shot. But against Mario Bautista, he does leave that window open. And that's been my big point about Bautista. He reminds me of, there's grapplers like Gerald Meerschaert out there who, not everyone's Jacare, who they have 20 submission wins and no submission losses, even though Jacare has one submission loss. Some grapplers, they have like 11 submission wins and like 4 or 5 submission losses. You get, if you just grapple a lot, some other guys are going to out-grapple you. You're going to out-grapple some other guys.
Like a Charles Rosa.
Exactly. That would be a very good example. For Mario Bautista, he does almost strike in that way to where I'm a very good striker, but I do leave holes open to where if you do have good power and if you do throw awkward strikes, he will leave himself open. And it is because he focuses so much on his own offense. He is somebody who goes to the body, goes to the head, will mix in his own kicks. But the problem with Bautista is that he will, in, I don't know, in search for more offense, just completely abandon his own defense. And that's something I do worry. I guess a guy like Brian Kelleher who can drop you and on your way up get in that guillotine.
Going back and watching Bautista on the tape, I agree with you 100%. He'll go for those combinations. And again, he can rip to the body, go overhand right, finish with a kick. And then we're still right here and our hands are down. And then he gets hit a couple of times. And against a guy like Kelleher that throws a lot of power shots in tight, Kelleher is one of those guys. And you hate it. Tall guys that have range, but they have no idea how to use it. Short guys that don't have range, but never get on the inside and try and jab their way in. Brian Kelleher knows how to get in and out. And I make the comparison all the time. Obviously, it's out there because Kelleher finishes a lot of fights by guillotine. There's two guys that you can compare him to. One's Nick Lentz.
The Carney.
Two's Georgie Karhanian. All three of those guys, they fight very similarly. In and out. A lot of guillotines. They give themselves up positionally.
I'd say Nick Lentz is like the Charizard of this Pokemon evolution, though.
Yeah, I mean, Charmander is, of course, Georgie Karhanian.
Yeah, yeah.
In the middle's Kelleher, which is odd because Karhanian was a champ with World Series, but that's neither here nor there. Brian Kelleher had a good run with Ring of Combat and 2 wins over Julio
Nick Lentz
Arce.
Almost fought Conor McGregor at 145, but everybody forgets that.
And he would have beat him, too. But Matt, when it does come down to this fight, I mean, a few of the things that I wanted to throw out there, obviously, we see the fact that these guys have some bonuses on their career. You look at it for Kelleher, 3 performance bonuses, 2 fight of the nights, 1 against Damian Stasiak, 1 against Hunter Azure, where Kelleher got beat in that first round. And then Hunter Azure had nothing left in the tank in the second, and Kelleher was able to finish him. We look at the odds for this fight. Kelleher opened to plus 120, plus 130 right now. Bautista's line has moved a little bit. Open to minus 140, minus 160. I almost said it like Joey Bats with the Blue Jays. Bautista, see you later. We have a look, though, at the Topology vote. Surprise to us, there to you. I will say over-under on the fresher, younger fighter who has much less in terms of experience on his record. I'm going to say over-under 67.5% Bautista.
I was going to say 70, so above.
You're going to say over? Slightly under. 451 total votes, 59% Bautista, 71%, sorry, 81% by decision for the 41% that have Kelleher, 57% by decision, 21% by submission, 16% by knockout. So, Matt, again, I do look at this one. If you're Bautista, do you sit there like every Friday night in like your living room by yourself with the lights off, kind of like Shia LaBeouf in the movie theater, like smiling and crying a little bit at the success that you had against Corey Sandhagen in his debut?
I mean, him and Uriel Contra are probably hand in hand in that theater together if that is the case.
Yeah, and listen, you have to be a hardcore of a hardcore to understand that reference. But I look at this one, Kelleher, Instagram, just got married like 2 weeks ago, so that's cool. Like a lot of wedding pictures out there, so good for Brian Kelleher. I'm sure his lady's a fan of that. But when I look at this one, Matt, for Bautista, training with John Crouch, whose name we never hear, barely ever, at the MMA lab, you look at the training partners for this fight. Kyler Phillips is one of those guys, but I look at the head coach of Benson Henderson as a guy that's going to be able to work you through some of those positions that if you overextend yourself, Benson Henderson's the king of a scramble and a submission. Brian Kelleher is cut from that same type of cloth. Not necessarily the same in the scrambles, but Kelleher is very good in those aspects. So for Bautista, that's a great wrinkle to have in your game plan. Kelleher, though, fight in, fight out, very, very good. And you look at the losses, it's the good competition. Obviously, Nurmagomedov's his last loss. That's forgivable.
Can I be honest? I think he's going to lose like Court McGee lost to Jeremiah Wells. Like, I learned a lesson last weekend. Here's the thing. Brian Kelleher has a good chin. I think we can all agree on that. You know how we know he has a really good chin? It's because he gets hit clean in a lot of his fights. Even when he wins by a landslide, there's still a moment in all of his fights where he's getting hit by clean shots. And yes, he doesn't always go down from them, but Mario Bautista is the type of guy who, when he hits you clean, you are going to go down from it. And he's a much younger, much more explosive type of athlete. I really think this is a poor stylistic fight for Brian Kelleher because he is the type of fighter who will be willing to strike with Mario for a little bit early on in this fight. And I think he's going to get clipped hard in that early going.
Kelleher likes to strike himself into a clinch and then work from there. He can pound the uppercuts, he can work the body, he can take you down. Mario Bautista is very good in the clinch, understands his big frame at 135 pounds, and if you try and clinch him up, he's really good at getting that plumb, then snapping your neck out of the way and spinning out of there, landing elbows on the break. So I like Bautista in this fight as well. Doing the tape study for this one was an absolute pleasure. If you don't get the chance to go out there, please do watch some of their fights because it's a lot of fun. But both of us going with the man now out of Arizona, previously out of a small town in Nevada, it is Mario Bautista. Can't wait for the fights coming up this weekend. 12 on the docket, Zarukian and Gamrot in that main event. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, like the ultimate warrior against Bonesaw, Randy Savage at WrestleMania number 7. This is one of those fights. This arguably is a loser leaves town fight between Cody Durden out of Georgia and the young savage JP Bayes. And I don't take any solace or pride in saying any of this, but for Bayes in the UFC, he's had 2 fights. Matt, he's been knocked down 7 times. I can count these on my hands. That's not good. 3 times in his debut, 4 times by Montel Jackson. Montel Jackson, over 10 minutes of control time in that fight, 4 knockdowns. The judges scored that contest 30-27, 30-27, 30-27. Montel must have been going, hey, it's a great way to win a fight, but where are the 10-8s? I don't know. But when it comes down to this fight, it's a couple of guys that have scuffled as of late. You can look at Cody Durden and his last fight. I consider that like Brian Kelleher's last fight. Kelleher loses to Umar Nurmagomedov. I go, okay. Well, I expected that. Cody Durden loses to Muhammad Makhachev, and I go, okay. I really expected that one. And for Durden, it's been a weird run in the UFC. Has that been great first round against Chris Gutierrez, the 10-8, but he emptied his tank and he had nothing left. He fights Jimmy Flick. They're John. They don't like each other. Jimmy catches him in an inverted triangle, and then Cody Durden still wants to fight him after that fight. What does Jimmy do? Retires. So they're never going to have that fight. He fights Arichi Lang. Has a great first round. Has a not as great second round. Third round's really close.
Has some Tony Kelly quotes.
You could have made the argument either way on that fight, and I can talk, you know, out of either side of my mouth about Durden, Arichi Lang, but I thought Arichi Lang had a pretty good claim to winning that fight. Regardless of that, though, for Durden, he's such a fast starter in that first round. He chains his takedowns together very, very well. His top pressure's not the best. Like, guys get back up, because he is a guy that's more position over submission, even though he does have plenty of finish wins on his record. But this is a guy, again, had a kickboxing, boxing, and MMA fight all in the same night. So, you know, he's all about that life. But at flyweight in this one for Bays, he also has that wrestling base. And I want to make sure I get this one right because he was, back not that long ago, the former EFC interim flyweight champ, the former EFC bantamweight champ. And coming in, he had a strong wrestling base in his own right. He was an African wrestling champion. And we saw that on the way up. We saw that on Contender Series when he took on a short notice opponent. There was a change. He was supposed to take on Nate Smith. He ended up with Jacob Silva. And Matt, JP Bays was minus 490 favorite in that fight and won it somewhat predictably. But again, against Bruno Silva, knocked down three times. Montel Jackson knocked him down four times. Get knocked down, can't get back up again, but here we are.
It's just, what's JP Bays' backup plan if he can't take his opponent down?
Because bang.
So far, or get banged, like try to break his opponent's hands with his chin, because JP has taken an ungodly amount of damage in his last two fights, and the Montel Jackson fight was straight up hard to watch. He had one moment in that fight where he took his back, got him in a rear naked choke, but Montel Jackson is my favorite submission defense of all time, which is just like, relax and look very uninterested, and eventually they'll let go, because that's exactly what happened.
All Montel Jackson watched when he was a kid was cartoons about quicksand.
That's it, because he was just like, okay. And immediately got back up to his feet and started bombing on JP. And that's really been the story about JP throughout his UFC tenure. And I'm glad you bring up his wrestling background, because if you do watch his fights before he comes to the UFC, it is very much a part of his style. That is his bread and butter. He is going to go to that well over and over and over again. And it's almost weird because I don't think I'd ever recommend this, but JP should fight more like Vanessa Demopoulos. Just be aggressive on the feet and crash the distance to get close to your opponent, because he will kind of just stand on the outside and wait. And when he is waiting, that's what opponents can take advantage of him on the feet, and they can crack him hard. He doesn't move well with shots. This has been something that Chris Weidman struggled with for the entirety of his career. I just remember when Weidman fought Jacare, and there was one time Jacare hit him with an overhand, and he kind of like went across the cage. Joe Rogan was like, wow, Chris Weidman finally learned to roll with shots. He's never looked better. And then 2 seconds later, he gets crippled by an overhand.
Awful stoppage.
Terrible stoppage. But it's just, JP doesn't roll well with shots. There's some fighters, like Gouram when he fought Demir, both the guys were doing it very well. When they would get hit, they move their head in the direction that the punch is coming, because it lessens the impact of the punch. Yes, there might be some people who think like, wow, he must have got hit really hard. But if you've watched the sport long enough, you can kind of realize that no, they're lessening the impact of the shot. JP is very stiff with his striking defense, and that's something I worry about basically against anybody, because Cody Durden is not the most dangerous guy in the feet at all, but he can definitely flurry together with his own strikes. And if JP is getting caught like a deer in headlights, you could see one of those moments where he's behind the two black lines. He is kind of waiting. He's not confident in his own takedown attempt, and he could get flurried on against the cage and maybe not finish, because Cody Durden's not necessarily that high level of a striker. But I just worry about JP when he's on the defense in most situations, and I think that's a wrinkle he's gonna have to fix overnight.
This is one of those matchups that I feel like, you know, JP's taking so much damage, we'll give you Cody Durden, Durden's gonna wrestle you, a spot where to really get it and hammer it home. He's a 2012 Greco-Roman African champion in wrestling, had a high school background in that as well, and trains at Extreme Couture now, which obviously lends credence to the wrestling. For Durden, he was with American Top Team Atlanta for the longest time. He's trained at Big ATT as well for this camp. But you watch Durden, he must just watch like hype videos of TJ Dillashaw that are set to Can't Stop by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, because he comes out so hot in that first round that in the second round, not as hot, he can stop. And then the other thing about it is his hands drop, stop, and now we're in the
like
second round.
Is hot.
And they drop down near his hips, and he throws odd angle punches from the hip. But the biggest part about it is his striking defense goes completely out the window, and his head is right there to be hit, and it doesn't move. Now, sometimes he does the, you know, I jerk my body out of the way, but his feet are square in front of you, so he is there to get hit. It's just a matter of, can Durden carry everything forward into the third round? His last third round against Arichi Lang was close-ish. And again, Durden showed a little bit more than he had in some previous fights. But again, this one is a close enough fight, and it is well matched. So if you have a look at the odds, Bays open a plus 125 underdog, minus 115 now, the slightest of favorites. For Durden, open plus, minus 145, minus 107 right now. So the line has flipped, albeit still close. We have a look at the Tapology votes. They're going to be close, so surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under The guy who has a win in his UFC belt, Cody Durden, 65% over-under.
I'll say over.
I'm thinking under. It is over. 536 total votes, 70% Durden, 83% by decision for the 30% that have Bayes, 52% by decision, 29% by submission, 12% by knockout, Matt. If Durden opened a minus 145 favorite, and I can get him as an underdog in this matchup, you're darn tootin', I'm going to take him.
Yeah, I like Cody Durden a lot in this fight. JP, I don't even know, is like a UFC caliber fighter, and I don't feel good saying that.
Talk about
that.
The strengths.
Really, he's quick. A good wrestler. He has good cardio, and if Cody Durden shows up to wrestle him, then maybe he can out-grapple Durden for two rounds, and that's only if Durden gets exhausted after the first one, though.
Which is a thing.
It is, but he has one-third rounds in his UFC career, and JP just eats punches like it's going out of style. I think there's a lot of weaknesses in JP's style, and I really do think that at the UFC level, it doesn't matter about your strengths nearly as much as it matters about how many weaknesses you have. We see it all the time at the higher levels, and I just think with JP, yes, his cardio is an advantage. Yes, his scramble ability, if you will, is an advantage, along with his wrestling, but I don't think his wrestling's dominant enough to really go out there and get him a spot in the top 15, like a Gregor Gillespie, perhaps, or even like an Armin Zarukian, we're going to see later on in the main event, although he has well-rounded his game out. So I just worry about JP's at this level. Maybe he can out-wrestle Cody Durden. Maybe he can weaponize his cardio. I just don't think this is the fight he'll be able to do it in.
I'm staying away from it, but I will pick the underdog in this matchup. Both of us going with Cody Durden to get the win. Let us know down below in that comment section who you have. Shavkat Rakhmonov is going to be fighting Neil Magny. That's pretty cool. And also, Armin Tsarukian is going to be taking on Mataj Gamrot. So you're going to want to keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, a clash of styles between the first fighter out of Kazakhstan that's on this card, because of course we have Shavkat Rakhmonov. I'm talking about Sergey Morozov. He's going to be taking on the man known as Howlin' Paiva. And Matt, if you watch Howlin' Paiva's fights that have been in the UFC through different lenses, you're going to get different results. If you wanted to give him a nickname, it would be Brazilian Oddball. Or maybe if he decided to walk out to like some, you know, I wouldn't say obscure country stuff, but some outlaw stuff like a Coulter Wall, you call him the new Brazilian Cowboy. Or he could walk out to the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme song, because in some of his fights, he's looked amazing. In some of his fights, he's won, but I didn't think he won them. And then in some of his other fights, it's like, hey, this guy's dead to rights. Why isn't the referee stopping this fight? Only for him to come back and then win said fight. And that was his second to last fight against Kyler Phillips. But Matt, for Howlin' Paiva, I say clash of styles from the outset, but this guy, for a primary striker, has very good takedown defense throughout his UFC career. And if you look at it, Sergey Morozov, M1 Global champ of yesteryear at bantamweight, he had the great fights against Josh Reddinghouse. He comes into the UFC. He loses to Umar Nurmagomedov. All right, well, that guy's pretty special. He's also on this card, so the guys probably look at each other in the hallways very awkwardly. But you look at it. Then he goes out there and beats Khalid Taha, absolutely out-wrestles him, beats him everywhere. And then he takes on Douglas Silva de Andrade in one of the best fights you're ever going to see for Douglas Silva de Andrade, because Morozov drops him with a right hook. It's great. Gets him down to the ground, where Morozov is in his element. He's not able to get the finish. It's a 10-8 first round. The second round starts, and D. Silva knocks him down three times and wins that fight by submission. So if you look at it for Morozov, obviously his last fight was absolutely wild. It seems to me like that fight was very, very recent. It was about 3 months ago. So he's taking on Howlin' Paiva, who got knocked out about 5 months ago against Sean O'Malley. Before that, he took on Kyler Phillips. He was on wobbly legs. I counted four times in that one. And at the end of that first round, he looked like he was completely out, but the referee let it go on.
But this is my whole thing. I agree with you. He looked like he was out, but he did win the next two rounds. So was he really out? Like, that's the thing that you always have to say. If you were knocked out, you're probably not going to be able to outfight a guy for the next 10 minutes. Howlin' Paiva was still able to do that against a guy like Kyler Murray, Kyler Phillips, sorry, not Kyler Murray. Kyler Phillips, who I know he's a little bit up and down with his style, but he's still looked at as one of the better fighters in this division. So for Howlin' Paiva, I understand. I do kind of agree with you on that. But on the other hand, he was still good enough to go out there and dominate. Not dominate, it wasn't a close fight, but still, he was still good enough to go out there and really look good for the next 10 minutes. So for Paiva, I almost look at that as a positive, because if he is going to go out there and fight Sergey Morozov like he fought Kyler Murray, Kyler Phillips, goodness, I did it again, or like how Morozov fought Douglas Silva de Andrade in his last fight, he's going to have to take a shot or two, and he's going to face some adversity at some point. But this is the thing that's been in the back of my mind after I saw Sergey Morozov his last time out. That wasn't his only hard fight of his career. Like, he's been in a number of difficult fights. I think it's starting to catch up to him at 33 years old. Like, I don't look at him as necessarily being a classic 33-year-old. Like, normally in MMA, you're just kind of in the middle of your prime. Like, this is a great time to be alive for an MMA fighter. But he has had a number of very difficult fights. There's another fight on this card where I'm going to talk about that, too. But for Morozov, I'm starting to worry about his susceptibility to getting hit by big shots. How is his cardio going to look late in fights? Like, how far can he bend before he's going to break in a lot of these matches? Because the damage is starting to pile up on him. And against a guy like Halion Paiva, who, yes, it might take him a couple minutes to get adjusted to a fight, but when he's in his rhythm striking with his own Muay Thai, like, let's say Morozov is not shinny, but let's say he's not as durable as he once was. If Paiva cracks him with a big shot, I do worry about Morozov not being 100%, getting back up to his feet, maybe getting hit by another big shot and getting knocked out, or maybe even leaving his neck open, getting submitted. I just think Paiva on his best day does offer a lot of interesting questions for Morozov if Morozov isn't at 100% anymore.
I worry about both guys, and I agree with you. I mean, Morozov had some really crazy fights over with M1 Global. I bring up the Redding House fights, but again, and I'm going to talk about it later on in this card. You have Adolfo Vieira. Go watch his crazy grappling matches against Marcus Almeida. They went at it 8 different times. It's a lot of fun for Morozov. Not 8 times with Redding House, but Redding House, after the fact, was on The Ultimate Fighter. Not the season that's on right now, but the season before. That's how high, of competition Redding House is, not to mention the fact that he is also from the continent of North America. So good for him. But I do look at this one as, for Morozov, yes, he did get knocked down 3 times in his last fight. In the second round, he got choked out. He kind of looked a little bit slower after he unloaded the tank in that one. If you look at it for Paiva, he got dropped in the fight against Kyler Phillips. He got rocked at multiple occasions. He got knocked out against Sean O'Malley. So again, durability, a little bit of a question mark. Now, obviously, Paiva, much younger in his career, even though he has so many fights, 25 fights for him. You have the 22 for Morozov. But I went through it. I mean, you look at the way that Paiva fights, and again, you bring it up, Muay Thai striker, very, very good defensive hips. He's good up against the cage at defending some of these takedowns, which is a specialty of Morozov. Morozov will go for some unorthodox things too. You look at the way that Morozov strikes, and he walks guys down, and he's one of those guys, kind of like Andrea Fialho when Fialho's flowing, that he likes to land that left hook, lead left hook, and then follow it up with a right hand that's very quick. So I like that over Morozov. For Paiva, though, he'll stand kind of square because he's so much taller than most of the fighters he takes on. So he's already got that hunch to him so he can defend some of those punches. Lands a good pawing jab. It doesn't have a lot of zip behind it. And sometimes it's more of a range finder. When he finds that overhand right, that's his best weapon that I've seen from him.
This is my only issue with Paiva, though. And I do agree with that. But in every situation we've brought up, he's in the defensive. It's him reacting to what Morozov's probably going to be doing to him and not the other way around. And that's why I do like Sergey in this fight. I know I've thrown up a lot of red flags for him, but just the physical strength, the advantage that he should have in this fight should really help him, because if he does get on the inside against the much taller and lankier Paiva, I do expect him to finish some of those takedown attempts. And I don't think he will have to expend the same level of energy that he found himself doing against Andrade in that fight.
And if you look at it for Paiva, he's now training out of Team Alpha Male, done that for the last couple of camps, and he brought in Mohammed Makayev for this camp to get ready for Sergey Morozov, so a giant plus there. This was the thing that I want to hammer home with everybody. Alan Nascimento, I thought he won the fight against Paiva. It was a wild fight, but Nascimento only went 1 of 10 on takedown attempts. Kai Kara-France went 2 of 7. Rogerio Bontorin went 2 of 5. Mark De La Rosa went 0 of 2 in a fight that Mark De La Rosa had no success in. The next one, Zhalgash Zhumagulov, who had an argument that he won that fight, went 2 of 11. Phillips went 4 of 9. So, like, these guys aren't able to get takedowns against Paiva, and the ones that did...
4 of 9's pretty good.
But it was in the first round, a lot of it. But for Paiva, the biggest point is not a lot of control time against either. He pops right back up to his feet in the majority of these cases. So, for Morozov, that's so good at grappling, I'm interested to see if he decides to really go for that, fire on that early. We have a look at the odds. It opened at par. You have a slight favorite now in Morozov. I guess it's a minus 140. If you look at it for Paiva, plus 120 or thereabouts. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 60% Morozov.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It is not. 563 total votes. 67% Paiva. 83% by decision for the 33% that I'm Morozov. 68% by decision. So again, a lot of people thinking this one's going to go to a decision. Good defensive grappling at a Paiva, good striking. Morozov, very well rounded. Ayamorzov in this fight, but it is a really close one, and it's tricky because you don't love to take guys that have been knocked out so recently.
Exactly, and I know that was a big point that we brought up when Dinah Bakary fought Chung Ho Kong not that long ago, but in that fight, chin wasn't an issue for Dinah. Now, stylistically, it was a poor matchup for him. He didn't get the win. We were right on that one.
Yeah, let's go.
But sure. If you are worried about Morozov in this fight, especially after the damage that he took in his last one, in recent memory, it hasn't been as big of a deal for guys to come back after knockouts. Now, everybody's different, so don't put any stock into that. But I do think Morozov is going to be the more dominant fighter in this matchup. Could he get hit by a big shot early, get guillotined? Yes, he could. And honestly, this fight reminds me a little bit of when Renato Moicano fought Alexander Hernandez not that long ago, where Moicano's the rangier striker and get it done a little bit on the ground. And Morozov, being more like Hernandez, is really going to have to rely on his wrestling. So I'm going to pick Morozov, but this is a great fight.
Big time fight. Both of us going with Kazakhstan Sergey Morozov to get the win. We have some big time fights, including fellow countryman Demorozov, Shavkat Rakhmonov, who's taking on Neil Magny, and in the main event, Armin Zarukian taking on Mataush Gamrot. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. So I'm not saying if you're a Fight Night Picks fan, you should go to at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP, at Fight Night Picks. You should, but I'm not saying you need to. But if you do follow me in particular on Twitter, I threw it out there. I threw the old, whoa, what's going on here? I don't understand this. And I got some responses out of it. And you're probably out there going, Craig, just spit it out already. Okay. Shayulan Nordumbeka in his last fight took on Sean Soriano. And I'm going to talk a lot about Sean Soriano this weekend. People might find it weird, but it seems like the people that beat him in the UFC then had to go to Sanford MMA and train with him. Shayulan's one of those guys. But Shayulan takes on Sean Soriano. Takes him down, second round, third round. Sean Soriano, turns out, can't get back up to his feet. Soriano won the first round. Nordumbeka wins round two, round three. So Shayulan Nordumbeka goes from 19-7 to 20-7. And you can see it on the screen now. He's now 37-10, and you'll go, well, Craig, where did all the wins and the losses come from? And I'm going, hey, I don't really know. Okay, so what happened was Fight Finder, the team over there, obviously Jay Petry did the work. You saw that with Ashkar Mazarov recently when wins and losses came into account and he lost some wins and he gained some losses. For Shayulan Nordumbeka, well, he went from 20-7 to 37-10. So he gained 17 wins and he gained 3 losses to his record, which doesn't make a hell of a difference when you watch his fighting style, because I don't care how many fights he's had. So I went on to SureDog, Matt, and this is the craziest part about it. In 2016, he had 13 fights. In 2017, he had 18 pro fights and one amateur fight. 2018, he had 5 fights. 2019, 3 fights. 2020, 6 fights. 2021, 2 fights.
He's been getting them out.
This is the first fight he's had this year coming off that Sean Soriano win. 18 fights and one amateur fight in 2017.
What were you doing?
Not fighting that many times. But for Shayulan Nordumbeka, it's always weird when somebody gets 17 extra wins and 3 extra losses added to their record.
Is MMA even a sport? Like, this is the only sport that this happens in.
Nah. Just like that song with Joaquin Buckley.
Unless we're talking about Albert Pujols' age, this stuff rarely happens in other professional sports.
Robert Sargent threw it out there. We touched on this when Shayulan made his UFC debut in a fight that he wasn't able to win against Joshua Kolibau. I said, hey, this guy's as Sha space Yilan out there on the internet, or Shayulan Nordumbeka. That's how they were able to find the fights. But some of these obscure promotions that are happening in the middle of nowhere, it could be Canada, it could be the States, it could be China, it could be anywhere in the world. They're really hard to track down. And if you go by two different names, it makes it even more difficult.
That's why I often make a face anytime people say, I was going to say you, but I just do it anytime anyone says anything. When they go, hey, they have 9 world kickboxing titles. Do they, though? Like, you do have to do a deep dive, because anybody can hold a tournament and call it a World Kickboxing Championship, and if you win it, you can thereby consider yourself a World Kickboxing Champion. But anybody can set up the organization. Again, Joseph Altolini said this about Wonderboy Thompson, and it completely changed my mind about, like, everybody's background in every single mixed martial art. But you brought up a really good point. You know what that is? It shouldn't change anyone's opinion on how he fights, because his fighting style is still going to remain the same. Very wrestling heavy, loves the top position, is a pressure heavy fighter, but I do like his attentiveness, I would say, from the outside, because he won't just rush in at all times. He does strike his way on the inside. Now, against TJ Brown, I'm going to be very curious to see if he's going to be able to have a sustained level of success with his own grappling, because we know how big and physically strong a guy like TJ Brown is at this weight class, and I'm very worried to see if Nurmagomedov can have... Shylon can have long periods of success just on the mat against him, because Brown, like I said, is so physically strong that maybe you can have a minute here, a minute there, but I really do think that as this fight goes on, it is going to favor Brown, just because Brown can wear on him just in a way that I don't think Shylon can wear on TJ Brown.
I have a hard time with TJ Brown fights, and there's many, many reasons why. I mean, he beat Dylan Lockhart on Dana White's Contender Series. Lockhart was coming off a win in, you guessed it, the big city of Lewiston, Maine. I was there. He beat Jesse Erickson, and then Lockhart was on Contender Series, and I was like, wow, you gotta watch out for this guy. And Brown made it look very easy. Yeah. So he comes into the UFC, he's beating Jordan Griffin, he's completely dominating him, he wrestles himself into a submission and then loses by that submission, fights Danny Chavez, gets his lead leg kicked to pieces, and gets tired in that fight, goes out there and fights Kai Kamaka, wins a split decision, but everybody thought he lost that fight by split decision. And then he fights Charles Rosa's last time out. Rosa takes it on short notice. They move it up to 155 pounds. And in that fight, I mean, Rosa, round one, round two, it was a really weird fight.
I thought TJ Brown won that fight.
TJ Brown won that fight. But it's just, it's been a weird run for TJ Brown, because the things that he's very good at, offensive wrestling, his grappling, training out of Glory MMA and Fitness with Brandon Moreno and the like. He also trains at Westside MMA with his buddy out of Arkansas. You know him as Bryce Mitchell, top ranked featherweight, who's also in this division. But I look at this one as Brown's a bigger guy at 145, but I don't think the weight cut's very easy on him. And his cardio isn't necessarily the best out there, whereas for Shayulan Nordembeka, he's still there in the third round. He's still there to wrestle. It's just weird that he's a decent grappler when it goes down to the mat, but he takes some chances. He takes some liberties. Good with his ground and pound, but he can get swept out of some positions that he's very... Like, when you're in mountain, you're Shayulan Nordembeka, and you're built like an actual Wolverine, where your top's more like a Tasmanian devil, you'd think this guy has great top pressure. Not really.
And that's why I do like TJ Brown's just grappling style in this matchup. I don't think Shylon can get out from under TJ Brown. I'm almost certain TJ Brown could get out from under Shylon. I really do think he can have success even grappling off his back, because he can explode out of positions and then just continue to chain wrestle from that point and probably end up in the top spot. Again, I don't think TJ Brown is this incredible fighter by any means. I know you'll talk about the odds in a bit, but I do like Brown in this matchup just because stylistically, Shylon is going to have to wrestle at some point. And if he is going to get it into TJ Brown's preferred range, I just think Brown's going to be A, the stronger wrestler, and B, maybe even the slightly more technical wrestler in the way that he can hold Shylon down and not vice versa.
And we've seen Nordembeka gain in the striking. This is second camp at a big gym like Sanford MMA, or rather the first camp at Sanford MMA. He's a guy out of China Top Team in Beijing. You see him training with Li Jingliang. Pretty good. Pretty good, you know, ranked UFC welterweight. But you look at it for Nordembeka, goes over to Sanford to get ready for this fight, obviously with Sean Soriano, that he recently fought, which has to be awkward because Soriano's like one of the leaders in the gym there. So it's got to be weird, but good to see that relationship.
Well, it's like Giga and Calvin Cater popping bottles last night. They're boys now. It's all
couple of HUDs. But we have a look at the odds for this one. TJ Brown, open to minus 250 favorite, minus 212 right now. Nordembeka, open to plus 220, plus 172, record gate. How will it play out? What happened with the football? We have a look at the fan vote, Tapology vote. Surprise test there to you. I'm going to say over, under 67.5% Brown.
Under.
It's over, so 527 total votes, 75% Brown, 86% by decision for the 25% that have Nordembeka, 78% by decision. Matt, I said this before we started this video. I said, you know, there's probably somebody out there and they're going like, hey, minus 250 TJ Brown, I'm going to lay that chalk. Is somebody really going to do that?
I'm not.
Are they a silly goose?
It's like what we said in the first fight. I think TJ Brown's going to win, but not for these odds.
No, I mean, for Shayulan Nordembeka, I love the cardio. I love the fact that he has fucking 47 fights.
I just don't think... I like the cardio, but this is the big key to this. The way he uses his cardio isn't necessarily the way that TJ Brown struggles with it. If Shai Lan is going to weaponize his own cardio, he's just going to try to grapple even more than he otherwise would. And again, the grappling is really where I think he's going to struggle in this fight. And that's why I do agree with you. I do think he's going to have better cardio than TJ Brown. I just don't know if he'll be able to weaponize it in a way that, like, a striker with really good takedown defense will be able to weaponize their cardio against someone like TJ Brown.
Yeah, to me, I mean, Kai Kamaka, I thought he beat TJ Brown, like, hands down. Everybody on MMA Decisions did. There was, what, 9 that out of 29, 28, and 6 that out of 30, 27, Kamaka. All that to say, what does he do when he fights? He threatens with the takedown to work his striking, to then work his grappling. He's a more polished version of a guy like Shailan Nordembeka.
Stronger one.
For me, I like TJ Brown in this matchup as well, but minus 212, the line right now, seems a little silly for me. So if you like the underdog out of China...
Someone out there this weekend's going to have a Jin Yu Fry TJ Brown parlay, and I feel terrible for them.
Yeah, they are the silly goose. Matt, both of us in this one going with downtown TJ Brown to get the win. Red flags abound. Some big fights on this card, including Neil Magny and Shavkat Rakhmonov. The big one up at the top, Armin Zarukian taking on Mateusz Gamrot. Can't wait for it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, kickboxing meets Muay Thai between a couple of guys that are young in their MMA careers and another record that when you go on some sites is different than on others. We have the Black Jag, Carlos Ulbrich, taking on Tafan Dadon Chukwe. And Matt, I'm going to start it off with Carlos Ulbrich because people are familiar with this guy by now. He's a City Kickboxing staple. He's featured in all the promo material with Israel Adesanya, a little bit with Alexander Volkanovski, the Shane Youngs, and so on and so forth. But he's mainly known for the fact that he won the 2017 100kg King of the Ring Championships for kickboxing, and then he followed it up in 2019 at 92 kgs, winning the title over there. He's 4-1 on some sites. Other sites have him winning 2 fights in 2013, so he's 6-1 on our record tally. But if you look at it for Ulbrich, he had a wild fight against Kennedy Inzechiku. He had a great first round, and then in the second round, he looked like he had run 2 marathons, and he wasn't able to get the win there. But his last time out, he took on Fabio Charrant, who looked like he had better things to do and other places to be. And in that fight, Carlos Ulbrich beat him pillar to post every single round. So it was a showcase for Ulbrich. In each round, you had Mr. Fabio Charrant throwing less than 15 total strikes. So it was a really, really weird performance. But have we learned anything more out of Ulbrich that we didn't know? Because again, he's so young in his MMA career, out of the first 2 fights that he's had in the UFC to now.
These are the only opponents I want to see for each one of these fighters right now. I gotta be honest, I'm completely off to Fawn's hype train. I don't think he's that good of a striker in MMA. I think there's huge holes in his game, and I think he doesn't have a well-rounded enough game. Now let's go to the other side. I think Carlos Ulbrich relies on his left hook way too much and just stands way too high in the air with his hands down because he's used to striking with massive gloves on his hand. That's what I think about this fight.
Well, that's kind of where I'm at. You didn't steal my thunder, you just proved my point. That is it. If you look at the way that Carlos Ulbrich strikes, when he throws in combination, it's something to behold.
It's like, you know those tornadoes that take out everything? Like videos where it's like, oh, what a nice house with like a farm next to it. And that Wizard of Oz tornado comes through. That's Carlos Ulbrich when everything's going right. He's hitting you from both sides. He's being able to flow his combinations together. The problem is, the second that tornado runs out of steam and you just kind of see like 2 things of corn kind of fly through the field now, it's not a big devastating
force. Just the dust
force.
Devil.
That's all it becomes. Like Carlos Ulbrich, the second he becomes tired, becomes like a 15% version of himself. We talk about this all the time. Like, Josh Emmett was exhausted in round 4 and 5 against Calvin Kattar. And hey, he probably lost both those rounds. But guess what? He still fought in an intelligent manner, and he still fought like Josh Emmett. Carlos Ulbrich, if he was in that same situation against a guy like Calvin Kattar, he's probably just looking for a way out at that point. Like, I just don't think Carlos Ulbrich is willing to go through the stuff that a lot of other MMA fighters are willing to go through before they end up losing. And I know he went out on his shield against Kennedy in that fight, but he was so tired he could barely hold his hands up at that point. I just think Carlos Ulbrich, can he have flashy fights in the UFC? Yes, he can. But his style is very much kickboxing related. And that's why I just think he's always going to struggle at this level, because he does have that weird kickboxing defense of, I know you're going to take me down at a certain point, so I am going to be a little tense, and that's never a great thing to have in MMA. That's why Izzy is so much better than every other kickboxer who comes over. You see his range of motion, you look at the way he can move around, and you think, hey, that guy's a professional athlete. Carlos Ahlberg, when he's throwing punches, you think he moves that way, but then you look at the way he walks around the cage. Does he have the footwork of an elite MMA fighter? Not at all. He kind of just has flat feet and stomps around a lot. What version of this fighter are we going to get in the second and third round? Because neither guy's really known for their cardio.
Both guys match up well in terms of the fact that they're strikers by trade. I say Muay Thai for Tafan Chukwe, but you look at it and Matt doesn't like it. But 2016 and 17 WKA national champion, 2016 world champion. He's a champ over with IBJJF. He's a pan champ over there, blue belt in jiu-jitsu. So there is a basis of being well-rounded. 1-0 as a Muay Thai fighter in his lone stop there in 2019. But when I look at Ahlberg, he's the type of guy that throws so well in combination from either stance. And the craziest part is, lead leg kicks are wild. The hip flexibility for a big guy to get up that high, especially against a guy like Nzechukwu, to touch his ear with his leg.
He's like 6'6".
It's absolutely insane. But again, the trouble that I have is, what does Ahlberg do when he needs to play on the defense? Well, he doesn't bring his hands up. He plays the pullback game. And when you pull back with your head on the center line, especially in MMA, with your hands down, somebody can fake up high, go down low, take you down. There's so many different things you can worry about. Or you become Luke Rockhold and you get sent to the shadow realm. Now,
even Darren Till against Jorge Masvidal was the example I was thinking of, because Darren Till loves to pull back. Masvidal switches stances, so he's basically throwing a power shot from his lead side now, and all of a sudden the power shot's coming from a lot closer than you thought it was, and you're getting clipped on the chin and getting knocked out.
To me, watching an Ahlberg fight, it's kind of like a Crystal Pepsi. You know, we're here for a good time. It might not be the best soda pop that's out there, but you're going to enjoy
it. Wait, so aesthetically pleasing, but ultimately disappointing?
I like a Crystal Pepsi. I really do. And when they come out, I have to get one. Wow. But I do focus on this when I watch Tafan Chukwe and when I break this fight down. Can Carlos Ahlberg have success? 110%. For Chukwe, the highs have been high in the UFC. The lows have been really low. His last fight against Azamat Mirzakhanov, close enough, I guess, through the first two rounds. And then the third round late, he eats the flying knee and he gets finished. I go to the fight against Junyoung Park. He gets dominated pillar to post. You know, it's not a good look. He gets taken down. I focus on the fight he has against Jamie Pickett. It's all volume. He's able to mix it up. The fight he has against Slow Mike Rodriguez, he mixes it up. When it comes down to my overall pick for this fight, though, is Slow Mike the best fighter? He got a win last weekend.
Where, though?
Slow Mike is 6'4", as is Carlos Ahlberg. Slow Mike has an 82.5-inch reach. Ahlberg is 77. Slow Mike's not the striker that Carlos Ahlberg is, but Tafan Chukwe is a very short and, you know, muscle-bound 205-er. Could he fight at middleweight? I thought he would. He has in the UFC, but it looks like 205 is the play. What does Tafan do incredibly well when it comes down to his fight style? Close the distance, clinch up, throw elbows, knees, and uppercuts in the clinch.
I don't think those things are going to matter, though. I agree with you, that's his best play, but here's the thing. I know we talk about reach and how it's not a positive or a negative. It is just a stat. With world-class strikers, though, it is a positive. Like, Carlos Ahlberg is one of the few fighters who can weaponize his reach and work behind it. Now, once he gets tired, you worry about those floodgates, and maybe he will go into some bad habits, if you will, and get back up to the cage. But for as long as Carlos Ahlberg has any gas in his tank, I really do think he's going to be the superior striker on the outside in this matchup. The only thing I worry about is that Tafan can go for takedowns. He'll shoot for double legs. He can get kind of caught in those in-betweens where he's shooting for the hips, and they just sort of defend him up against the cage, and that's it. So I think Carlos Ahlberg, since he's not facing a natural wrestler, since he's facing a guy who will take him down but doesn't necessarily have the technique of an upper echelon striker or wrestler, I do think this fight does favor Carlos Ahlberg for those reasons.
So Chukwe opened a +120, +105, excuse me, or thereabouts. We have a look at Ahlberg, opened a -140, -125. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Ahlberg.
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under, slightly under. So 523 total votes, 69% Ahlberg, 59% by decision, 35-ish% by knockout. For the 31% that I have Chukwe, a slim margin, 44% by decision, 53% by knockout. I think we had a knockout in this fight.
So do I. This should be a fun fight for as long as it lasts. I know I haven't hyped it up as the most technical MMA contest of all time, but you have two pure strikers who are not afraid to eat a shot, to give a shot, and that normally results in a really fun fight. I just think Carlos Ahlberg technically is this slightly superior fighter. I'll be interested to see if Tafon can get this into like an elbow and knee range, because maybe that'll give the fight a different wrinkle that I wasn't expecting, but I do expect a lot of open cage striking, and if that is the case, I do favor Ahlberg.
To me, I like Chukwe on the in-betweens. We saw that against William Knight. That was the way that he was able to win that fight. We saw it against Slow Mike Rodriguez. He won in those positions. And for Carlos Ahlberg, again, this guy, if Crystal Pepsi's your jam, you're all about a Carlos Ahlberg fight. But Matt, we're split on the pick. You're going with Blackjag, Ahlberg. I've got the Don and Chukwe. Should be a great fight at 205 pounds while it lasts, because if not, and if it lasts too long, it's going to be awful. Yeah. And we have some big time fights left on this card. Neil Magny taking on Shavkat Rakhmonov, and in that main event, holy smokes, Armin Tsarukyan, Mateusz Gamrot. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. In a fight that I'm sure Steve Mazzagatti could get behind, couple of middleweights ready to hook him up. We've got Chris Curtis putting his 7-fight unbeaten streak on the line, taking on one of the best grapplers outside of MMA, period, Rodolfo Vieira. And the nickname that was always out there was the Black Belt Hunter. In the UFC, they haven't really carried that forward. And I'd say Fluffy Hernandez took that home with him and probably has it up on his mantle. But we look at this fight, Matt, and for Rodolfo Vieira, he beat Oscar Piotta and just embarrassed him in his UFC debut. Took on Saperbeg Safarov his next time out. Had the biggest goose egg you've ever seen on his eye that would make Albert Duraev cringe. He was able to go out there, get the finish, didn't need the doctor, the referee was cool with it. He goes out in his next fight, lays an egg, and then his last time out, he picked up a performance bonus by getting a third round submission stoppage over Dustin Stoyfus in a fight that he lost the first round, he won the second round, and then ultimately won the fight in the third round. Now, I want to start this video off by saying that Chris Curtis in his picture, his posture is awful. I don't know who said, like, lurch over there, pal, and we'll take this picture.
Just give him one of these, I think, you know?
I don't know what that's
about. Give him one of those, like the fist up?
Yeah, or just like...
Because they cut someone out of the other side of it, obviously.
No, I'm dead serious.
Sorry, I'm talking about the Tapology pick.
On our graphic, he's very hunched over. But the point being that Chris Curtis is on this wild, magical ride. He watches Fight Night Picks videos. He hates the Allen brothers. But he does like the fact that he was our 2020 Male Fighter of the Year co-award winner, I guess, to speak, with Fight Night Picks. Or 2021, because I don't know how years work. But when we look at this, Matt, Curtis coming into the UFC, we're saying, like, okay, 185 is not his weight class, but he's going to take this fight against Phil Haas. And he was losing the fight against Phil Haas until he wasn't losing the fight anymore and landed that nice right hook. He goes out there against Brennan Allen. He's losing that fight until he goes out there and he looks amazing and he's able to really hurt Brennan Allen in the middle of the cage, but especially up against the cage when he ends up getting the finish. But Matt, I mean, Chris Curtis, for as good as he is, as 185 is what it is, when you're taking on Rodolfo Vieira, we know how good he is at jiu-jitsu. And I mean, this is a guy that 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, IBJJF world champion, absolute world champion, 2015 ADCC champ. And the craziest part about it is coming into this fight, yes, he has that win over Dustin Stoyfus his last time out, but he was supposed to take on Wellington Turman early on in this year. Fight was scrapped. You had Vieira that wasn't able to make the walk. Go over to his Instagram. I'll throw the picture out there right now because this was the post that he had. It says, in a way, because it's all in Portuguese, and I don't know Portuguese personally, but in English, I translated it, waiting for a doctor to come and tell me if I'm really, what I really have, and if I'm going to be able to continue fighting MMA. Then 2 weeks later, he posts on his Instagram, first week back, brain is tingling. There was an article out there, he had what's known as a cerebral angiopathy to make sure the blood vessels in his brain are working and firing the way that they should. He's cleared to fight, so he's going to take on Chris Curtis this weekend.
Chris Curtis is by far the best fighter Rodolfo Vieira has ever fought in the UFC, and I genuinely don't even think it's close. Like, Fluffy Hernandez, I think, does have a decent ceiling to him, so maybe he could put it together in the future.
Remember when Piotta was a hyped-up prospect?
But this is my problem. Let's go back and look at the spoon-fed opponents Rodolfo Vieira has been given throughout his UFC tenure. Saperbeg Safarov, built like a bag of milk, is not a good UFC fighter whatsoever.
2% or whole milk?
Oh, whole milk without a doubt. There's the most...
Buttermilk.
He's whole cream, if he could be. He's whipping cream. Oscar Piotta, again, had hype coming into the UFC, had an awful run once he got here. Anthony Hernandez, at least going into that fight, was seen as, honestly, just the perfect stylistic matchup for Rodolfo Vieira. Like, hey, Fluffy, you can grapple a little bit. Rodolfo's amazing at grappling.
Fluffy takes some chances on the feet, so does Rodolfo.
Exactly. And that's the fight that we all kind of learned, hey, Rodolfo might be great at grappling, but there's a lot of weaknesses to his game, too. His cardio is almost non-existent, and I do think people going into the Dustin Strachan fight put too much stock into that. They said, hey, he got tired against Fluffy. Dustin has kind of one of those pitter-patter styles. Maybe he can take it late. But the thing about that fight was that Rodolfo never really had to push himself in that fight, so I still do think that those cardio questions have yet to be answered, because for Rodolfo, I still feel like the second he pushes himself in a fight, where he starts going for a lot of those judo takedowns, starts going for a lot of those high-amplitude, big, explosive takedowns, he's still going to get tired once he goes for two or three of those. And the thing about Rodolfo is, when you come from a background like jiu-jitsu, we've seen this a lot. Jiu-jitsu practitioners might become black belts on the ground, but then you get hit in the head and you become a brown belt. Then you get hit in the head and you become a purple belt. Strikes in MMA really do matter, and you set this up in the perfect way. Rodolfo Vieira is one of the best non-MMA grapplers we have ever seen. But being an MMA grappler is very, very different to being a grappler in the gi. And I do think Chris Curtis, with his unique blend of power punching and Rodolfo Vieira does not like getting hit whatsoever, good cardio, and I think we can all agree Chris Curtis is a very steady fighter for this division, and great takedown defense, I really do think Chris Curtis, other than the size disadvantage he has going into this fight, this is a great fight for Chris Curtis to get back on the train.
Like, Rodolfo Vieira throws wild, looping, winging shots that sometimes land. Like, you think of, like, other jiu-jitsu practitioners with heavy hands, they're out there. Jacare Souza, heavy hands, pretty technical when he needed to be. Damian Maia could throw some hooks when he needed to.
He likes that straight left.
Close the distance. But Rodolfo does have something that a lot of these pure grapplers don't have. His wrestling takedowns. You look at the fight against Vitaly Nemchinov over with ACA before Vieira comes into the UFC. Power double leg to then grab the back. Like, some people struggle. Like, Tabitha Ricci, great at judo, great at jiu-jitsu. Sometimes she has a hard time getting the takedown. Like, there's some of these fighters that they just struggle in those in-betweens. Rodolfo doesn't struggle with those. So I do look at this fight as Curtis, traditionally, good with his offensive takedowns. Don't see him going for those in this fight. Traditionally, pretty good with his defensive grappling. I mean, Phil Hawes went 0 of 3 on takedown attempts.
Pretty good wrestler.
Brennan Allen got tricky. He might be 0 of 3, but there's a point in that fight where he drops down, pulls guard just to grab Curtis's leg, and then he gets him into a leg lock, but Curtis gets out of it. If Rodolfo Vieira gets you in a leg lock, you're probably not going to get out of it.
Tap immediately so you can walk for the rest of the year.
Yeah, it's going to be bad. So that could happen in this one, Matt. But we have a look at the odds. And for Chris Curtis, this is the first time in his UFC career out of the three fights, I guess. Open minus 180, minus 160 right now. He is the favorite. Rodolfo Vieira, open plus 155, plus 133. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 62.5% Curtis.
I think it'll be 50-50.
50? Well, not at all. 602 total votes, 81% Curtis, 86% by knockout for the 19% that Vieira, 87% by submission. Matt, Craig Allen, one of those guys who would pull a promo before a Fluffy Hernandez fight to say how hot Rodolfo Vieira is right now, only for him to lose. So I've been on this Vieira train for a very long time. Do I pick Vieira in this fight? What do you think?
I'm not going to. I didn't know Chris Curtis wasn't a fan of the Allen boys, but I hope he's going to be a fan of this prediction.
After the Hawes and Allen fight, he was in the comments section. That's but he fun. Did repost our Fighter of the Year thing. He did like that.
Hey, Chris, you're an awesome fighter. I've never thought other than that. This is the thing about Rodolfo, and I kind of mentioned it. He hates getting hit. Like, to Brock Lesnar levels, does not like getting hit. And that's the thing. Jiu-jitsu players don't have... they don't really have a tolerance to being hit. And it's nothing against it. It's just the truth. In boxing and kickboxing and Muay Thai...
Pancration,
even. You have to adjust yourself to getting hit at a certain point. And I just think Rodolfo, he waited until he was like 30 years old to then start to adjust himself to then being getting hit by guys at the UFC level. And I think Chris Curtis, if he hits you once or twice, is going to make you reconsider your MMA career. He's probably going to make you want to start grappling a lot more. So if Vieira gets the first takedown, if he doesn't have to think too much about it, then I think he can have a lot of success. So I'm going to break this fight down like Robbie Lawler, Nick Diaz, because I remember clearly saying, I think Nick Diaz can look good, but once anything bad goes for him, he's going to quit. And luckily, that's exactly what happened. He broke his nose and he quit in that fight. I think Vieira has kind of that mindset. Like, if he gets hit early, if he gets that big mouse on his eye again, if he does break his nose, I don't expect him to then rally past that and get a submission. So I do think Chris Curtis, if he can have success early, can carry it late. And I don't think Vieira can have that same type of longevity in his game plan.
A man that did a big time promo for Vieira only to land on my face, then when he fought Dustin Stoisfus, I still picked him to win. It hurts, Matt. So for me, I have Chris Curtis. The reason why is the fact that his striking style lends credence to a win against a guy like Vieira. What does he do so well? Well, when he stands there in southpaw, he throws that lead right hook on the in-betweens when guys are coming in. He also counters with the left of the body, and he'll rip that in open space too. He works head-body to great effect, and that's what ended up hurting Brendan Allen. It was going to the body, coming up top, wobbling him, going back up against the cage, and then throwing uppercuts and everything he can in the clinch. For me, I like Curtis in all of the in-betweens, and I like him in open space. I like Vieira with his wrestling and his jiu-jitsu, so I have a hard time. I think we're going to get a finish in this fight. I don't see it going to decision. If it goes that way, it would knock my socks off. But I'm also in agreement. I'm going to go with the Action Man, Chris Curtis. I can't wait for the fight. Both of us going with the man that trains out of Syndicate MMA versus the guy who's working out with former lower league NHL, adjacent leagues, Matt Schroy out of Fusion XL in Rodolfo Vieira. It's going to be an amazing fight. We have some big-time fights up at the top, headlined by Zarukian, who's taking on Mateusz Gamrot. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Win streaks collide at 135. Coming up this weekend, we have the undefeated 14-0 Umar Nurmagomedov taking on a guy who's on a four-fight win streak. You know him as Mayhem Miller? It's Nate Maness. And for Nate Maness, this is a guy that, coming into the UFC, I guess I had a bad read on him. He's perennially an underdog. He came up to Canada. He took on Big Cat Jesse Arnett for the TKO title. And I thought, there's no way Nate Maness wins this fight. And then he comes out, and he comes back, and he beats Jesse Arnett. And then he ends up in the UFC. Now, you look at the way that he's able to do it. He loses title to Taylor Lapolis, which is fine. The Lapolis brothers doing the damn thing. He beats 3-2 Kellen Van Camp on the regional scene. And then he fights Johnny Munoz Jr. in the UFC. And he wins that fight. And that was almost 2 years ago. Did I think Nate Maness won that fight? No. I thought Johnny Munoz Jr. won that fight. So then he goes out there and he fights Luke Sanders. And he comes back and he beats him in that fight. And he rallies. And then he fights Tony Gravely. And he loses the first round of that fight. And in the last 5 seconds of that one, he gets dropped. He gets dazed. Like, he's out. And I thought, okay, this fight's going to end between rounds.
You would make so many early stoppages as a ref.
Yeah, I don't know if it even would have been an early stoppage. But Maness comes back and then finishes Gravely. Drops him. And then on the ground, he pounds him out. So for Nate Maness, he has all these comeback wins, he has all these impressive wins, and he has this win streak to fall back on. He's decent at grappling, he's good with his boxing, he understands his frame in this division. Against Umar Nurmagomedov, I don't think any of those skills work for him, and I think he loses this fight, which isn't surprising because Nurmagomedov is one of the biggest favorites you're ever going to see out there.
As he should be, and the thing about Umar is that he did have a lot of questions coming into the UFC because he was so raw by the time he came over here.
And then he had a really bad knee injury from the Morozov fight to his fight against Brian Kelleher. That's why he was out for a long time.
Exactly. He had a really bad knee injury, and a lot of people were worried about just what his level of explosiveness was going to be when he came back. I have great news for everybody. Umar Nurmagomedov is like Ronald Acuna Jr. Injuries just don't seem to bother these people, and they can come back and be 100%. Umar, this is the best thing about his game. He can be all the way in or all the way out or all the way in with his striking or his grappling. And that's just kind of the perfect fighter at that point. He has a lot of the intangibles that you look for. When you think about fighters who are in the top 5, top 6, top 7 of their division, Nurmagomedov had a lot of those coming into the UFC, and he has been able to refine his style quite a bit up until this point. Now, with Maness, you said it. He is very well-rounded, and he should offer at least one thing in this fight that we haven't seen Nurmagomedov deal with yet. Maybe he can daze him at some point. Maybe he can make him tired just with some of his wrestling defense. I just think with Nurmagomedov, his kicking ability is phenomenal. His footwork is second to none of this division. He's gotten to the point now where we are going to have to see him take that big jump up in the rankings. I don't like comparing fighters to Khamzat Chimaev, because really up until he fought Gilbert Burns, we had never really seen a fighter with his level of hype and skill up until that point, because there was all those stats. He was outstriking his opponents, what, like 400-3 combined? It was wild. For Nurmagomedov, though, I do think we are going to have to see one of those, like, unranked to top 6 jumps, if you will, because I don't need to see him beat up on guys who are unranked as a minus 700 favorite, because I very much do expect him to win this fight.
Like, I'm looking at Umar Nurmagomedov, and maybe the next fight is somebody like, Jaime Barcelos, Victor Henry in that category, because once you start to get up near the rank, like, they're not going to do Frankie Edgar that bad, are they?
I think you could do Adrian Yanez.
I don't think you want to ruin a prospect.
I agree with that, but I got to be honest. I do think Yanez could maybe deal with him a little bit on the feet. It's just, he's going to need someone of that caliber at a certain point, because I do feel like we are both on the exact same page. Like, Nurmagomedov should not fight a guy without a number next to their name, because he's probably going to win by stoppage.
Yeah, so I look at this fight, and I will say, so for Nurmagomedov, trying to give him the technical breakdown, he doesn't use his hands all that much. He uses kicks like punches, which is weird to say, but in theory, it is odd. So he'll throw teep kicks. He'll throw front kicks. He'll throw question mark kicks. He'll throw spinning back kicks. He throws kicks all the damn time. And the one thing where you've got Nate Maness and he can capitalize on it is the fact that when some of those Umar Nurmagomedov question mark kicks, they are speedy, but on some of them, he takes a little bit off to try and set up other shots. And in those in-betweens, Nate Maness has great straight shots down the middle with his boxing, and he has a lot of power. So that's the one spot where I can see Maness having success. But in a lot of positions, he's playing on the defensive in his fights. Now, again, 3-0 in the UFC, and in 2 of 3 of those fights, he hit as an underdog, so good opportunity for him here. But Nurmagomedov, open to minus 500 favorite, minus 7888 right now. For Nate Maness, open plus 375, plus 524 as it stands. We're going to have a look at the Tapology votes. I don't anticipate they're going to be close at all. I'm not even going to pick an over-under. 95% have Nurmagomedov. 67% by submission for the 5% that I'm Maness. You 5% you. 47% by decision, 44% by knockout. So, Matt, for me, I mean, I don't want to sound too one-sided. Hopefully I've given Maness his flowers, because he's impressed me. I didn't expect a whole heck of a lot coming into the UFC, and he's turned out to be a pretty tidy fighter, very well-rounded, good enough takedown defense, good offensive striking. And on the defensive, he does put up a good shell against some of these guys. Against Nurmagomedov, though, a guy that throws kicks to all three levels with blinding speed, and also, by the way, didn't even talk about it, grappling's his strongest suit. The only guy I've seen pose Umar Nurmagomedov any threat was in his PFL Showcase prospect fight against Saeed Yakub Kakrakmanov, where they both went at it.
He's pretty good.
And even still, Nurmagomedov looked very good in that fight, and you know how good Saeed Yakub is. He's got a fight coming up very soon. And he beat Brian Kelleher, so...
That's what I mean, like, when you have wins over guys who have beaten other UFC-level fighters, like, it just tells you how good this guy was before he even made it to the UFC level. And I know coming from PFL isn't that big of a jump, but you get the idea. A lot of people only follow the UFC as an organization, but if you have been paying attention, Nurmagomedov's been expected to be this guy for a long time. Now, here is the good thing, though. I do think he has improved his hands a little bit. I do agree with you. Very kick-heavy with his offense, but I do think he has started to make gains with his boxing, and that's really the last, like, infinity stone, if you will, before he's got it all figured out. Because, like you said, his grappling is phenomenal, even though he does like to rely on his stand-up until he really has to go to the wall for his grappling. For Nate Maness, I mean, good luck to him. Like, this is an opportunity to have, what, 3 massive underdog wins in a row, and that would be wild, especially to cap it off against a win, or with a win against Umar Nurmagomedov. It's just, this is a tough ask for anyone in the division.
Both of us going with the man who has no nickname but a squeaky clean record, Umar Nurmagomedov, to get the win. He's one of 2 very, very impressive undefeated prospects on this card. Co-main event spot, you have Shavkat Rakhmonov taking on Neil Magny. And in that main event, holy smokes, Armin Tsarukyan, Mateusz Gamrot. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend at lightweight, Thiago Moises looking to get back on a roll and back in the rankings, or at least rankings adjacent. The odds would suggest that people are trying to see the forest among the trees. He's taking on the Spartan, Christos Yagos. And for Yagos, a couple of things. A, Cody Stamann did the nickname good last weekend, beating Eddie Wineland. But 2, go to his Instagram right now, because he doesn't look anything like the picture that we have next to us. He shaved his head. He's got a beard. Like, nobody's going to recognize him. What do you think he's going to walk out to, Mac? Christos Yagos.
Hot boy summer? I don't know.
I was thinking like some Yanni or something. Really throw people for a groove. Yanni, great
the
mustache.
Greek?
Great hair.
Just
not Yanni.
His like face out there. I have Christos Yagos as my parlay piece.
I don't know anything about that. But I was talking about the guy. You know, he's really making the music, making the grooves. But the fight like this, Matt, for Thiago Moises, I mean, he's on a 2-fight losing streak, albeit to good fighter. To good fighter, like good fighter being Islam Makhachev in a main event, he stood no chance. In his last fight against Joel Alvarez, what the hell happened?
Joel Alvarez is pretty good. And he also had like a 15-pound weight advantage in that fight, which does help out a little bit, especially on the feet. This fight's weird though, because like Joel Alvarez is probably really fired up to watch this one. And then he's going to walk way far away from the main event because he never wants to witness either one of those men ever again. Like there's one fight where we can prop Alvarez up on. And then there's another fight where we're going to use Alvarez a lot as a measuring stick for the other guys. This fight should be interesting because Yagos and Moises have been around enough against the higher levels of competition in this division to where we do have a pretty good idea with what they're both good at. Yagos struggles with his cardio. I think we all know that at this stage of his career. But it's not necessarily just him having bad cardio. He does have a very high level of volume in the early goings of fights, be it with his wrestling or his striking, so you do expect him to tire down as the fight goes on. He's just never really been able to pace himself to the best degree. It's a lot of, hey, Yagos won the first two rounds, let's really hope he can survive this third one.
The only weird kind of anomaly, and we touched on it, the fact that Shailan Nurdumbeka beat Sean Soriano, so now Shailan trains the end of his camp at Sanford MMA. Christos Yagos goes out there, fights a hard pace against Sean Soriano round one, loses it. Round two comes out, submits him. Now Christos Yagos also trains at Sanford MMA full-time with Sean Soriano. Sean Soriano, punching bag for the trainers.
I completely forget where I was. I think Christos Yagos is going to have some success early on in this fight. Just with his ability to overwhelm with his own striking. Because Thiago Moises, he is an odd fighter. Like, he's very good. But there's still some areas he's great in. There's some areas he's very weak in. Defensively, he does have that deer in headlights ability to where if you do blitz him, you can have a lot of success early on. Again, Joel Alvarez isn't known as the greatest striker of all time, but when he was able to start moving forward on Moises, you could tell that there was just a certain level of just uncomfortableness on the feet for Moises. And I do worry about anybody else in the top 10 fighting him who's a good striker. Because at lightweight, yes, grapplers might be at the top of the division, but everybody's extremely well-rounded. And nobody really has that many weaknesses in the top 15 of this division. So it is going to be really hard for either one of these guys to make their way to the top, just being these one-note fighters that they have been.
I have such a hard time with this fight. And I know people are going to go, okay, Moises used to be ranked. Yagos doesn't pace himself. Moises is a favorite. I'm picking Moises. I went back and watched tape on this. I looked at everything I could. So for Moises, comes in off Dana White's Contender Series, which is a red flag these days. I mean, he had a lot of success over with LFA. Did Moises. He's been a longtime ATT guy. He's been there for about a decade now, and he's still only 27. So that really lends credence to the level of training partner, the level of guys you're going to get to have inside the cage with you. But you look at it. Lose to Benil Dariush. Forgivable in a UFC debut unless you're Alexander Hernandez, who got the win and Moises beat Hernandez. You look at it, he beats Kurt Holobaugh, loses to Demir Ismagulov. Okay, these things make sense. Beats Michael Johnson after losing the first round to him, which was a weird fight. Beats Bobby Green, but that fight was really, really close with people on either side of it. Beats Alexander Hernandez, that was early last year. So now Moises in the rankings. He gets Islam Makhachev, which was silly. It was kind of
But the problem is, Armin Tsarukyan in his UFC debut had a pretty good fight with Islam Makhachev, and the fact that Thiago Moises was able to build himself up to a main event slot against him, I expected a lot more out of Moises, especially because Makhachev isn't the dominant grappler that Khabib is. I think everybody needs to realize that. Like, there's guys out there who can grapple with Makhachev a little bit. The difference is, he has strength and cardio that are pretty much unmatched. Like, that's sort of what the Khabib school of wrestling is known for. Yes, technically they're very good, but they outpace you. They put a pace on you that most people can't keep up with. And that's what happened to Moises. Like, early on in that fight, he was kind of grappling with Makhachev. He was being sound defensively, but it just got to a point where the Makhachev avalanche was too much. And Moises, he just couldn't keep on swimming and keeping his head above water.
Now, the good thing for Moises in a fight like this is, okay, you can do that with Makhachev for a round, two rounds, three rounds. You get finished in the fourth round. Christos Yagos is not a four-round fighter. He's not a five-round fighter. Like, if you look at it, even Yagos in his fight against Carlton Minas, he's winning now. It's getting close. Like, now Minas can defend the takedowns or at least keep Yagos on his back to where he's getting back up to his feet. And Carl Minus had a bad run in the UFC. Like, we were sold an Alaskan bill of goods that was not delivered on. But when we do look at this one, honestly, I do have a hard time with it, because for Moises, I have this idea of him in my mind's eye that when I go back and I watch the tape study, when Moises fights mean, like when he fought against Alexander Hernandez, when he's gritting his teeth against his mouth guard, when he looks like he's got a dip in, like, this guy's a bad MF-er. But when Thiago Moises is struggling in the in-betweens, or he's getting pressured and he doesn't have anything to dish back out, he struggles, and Yagos is going to bring that fire and that pressure. So looking at the odds, Moises open to minus 300 favorite, minus 272 right now. Yagos open to plus 250, plus 195. So the odds going slightly in the favor of Yagos. We're going to have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. I anticipate the fans overwhelmingly have Thiago Moises. I'm going to say over under 85% Moises.
I'll say under, but I think it's like 80.
It's over. So 600 total votes, 92% Moises, 57% by decision, 32% by submission. For the 8% that have Yagos, 53% by decision, 33% by knockout. It doesn't surprise me, the fan vote there, but the odds kind of do surprise me. So what's your take here?
I like Moises, and I don't disagree with the odds, if I'm being completely honest, because Moises, to me, is a younger version of Christos Yagos with a higher potential to get a finish. He's a little bit cleaner with his jiu-jitsu on the mat. He has slightly better cardio. I would say much better cardio, if we're being honest. On the feet, I do worry about Yagos maybe banking a round, maybe even two rounds, just with his volume, because that's the thing about Yagos. Nothing he does has a ton of power behind it, but he still throws fairly hard, I'd say. They're big looping shots. They get a big reaction.
Good
the crowd
jab normally. On him, too.
Decent jab. But again, the problem is it does fall apart as the fight goes late. If Yagos could just learn to fight like a more tired version of himself in the first round, he'd be better. But he does change his style up considerably in that third round, to where it'll be a lot of backpedaling with his hands down, just really avoiding the fight more than trying to bank that last round and win. So I do like Moises in this one, but we do need to see a much better version than the guy who did fight Joel Alvarez his last time out.
I hate the volume out of a guy like Moises. When it's on the feet, like, yeah, when he cracks, when he's gritting his teeth, like, those are the best performances. I go back to that Hernandez fight one quite a bit. But when I do look at this one, Yagos, I could see him 100% winning the first round. Second round, let's see how this one goes. For Moises, he can build on some of these things. So I do like Moises ever so slightly. I find the line a little tricky, just like the Jin Yu Fry one against Vanessa Demopoulos. So both of us going with Brazil's Thiago Moises, but I got a lot of red flags going up in my head, Matt. We have some big fights left on this card. You've got Shavkat Rakhmonov, Neil Magny. You've got Tsarukyan taking on, holy smokes, the former double champ of KSW, Mateusz Gamrot. Should be some great stuff. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, if you have a look at this overall card, Tsarukyan taking on Mateusz Gamrot, and you saw the video that we did earlier about Cody Durden and JP Bayes, we touched on the fact that the Ultimate Warrior, Randy Savage, WrestleMania 7, it was a loser leaves town match.
CM Punk, Jeff Hardy's my favorite.
Warrior
example.
Gets the win. He's got his arms up in the air. He's got his foot on Randy Savage. It's an iconic moment. It's a giant win. Well, if you like that wrestling analogy, Ric Flair, Mr. Perfect, 1993 with Raw. That's Josh Parisian, Alain Badeau.
I think you need an example that you were alive for.
Yeah, I wasn't alive for that one. But regardless,
that's what I mean.
Loser leaves town. And Matt, Josh Parisian, Alain Badeau, couple of heavyweights that I'm surprised they're on the main card. Their UFC runs have been terrible. And if you disagree with me, I don't know what fight you're watching, bud. Because, I mean, for Alain Badeau, he hasn't won a meaningful fight, and I'm not joking, you can argue with me on this, in 4 years against 0-2 Yuto Nakajima. He wins that fight, and then he loses to Todd Stout. And you might go, yeah, but Craig, that's a win on his record. He got into the UFC. Watch the fucking fight. Because he gets mounted, he gets splayed out, and he gets rear naked choked, and then the commission in Quebec goes, hey, Todd, you got the old weed in your system. Instead of going no contest, they go, hey, Alain, you win this fight.
I couldn't imagine.
Like, it's ridiculous that that's what it is. So then Alain goes out and fights Tom Aspinall and loses quickly. And then he fights Rodrigo Nascimento, and he has success in the first round. Alain looked really good in the first round. In the second round, he gets knocked out standing, but that one's overturned because the Nevada State Athletic Commission went, there's some dirty, dirty substances in Rodrigo's blood. He doesn't get to pass
He's
that
like
test.
Miles Teller after filming Top Gun 2.
I don't know about that, but it's a no contest for Nascimento. So then Badeau goes out and fights Parker Porter, and he loses that fight. Alain Badeau hasn't won a fight in 4 years. 4 years. Josh Parisian, on the other hand, lost to Tony Lopez by knockout in 2017. Not good. Josh Parisian goes on Dana White's Contender Series, gets a win over Chad Johnson. Well, that's pretty cool. But I go back before that, Matt, because I went through and I watched a lot of Josh Parisian. He loses by finish to Michel Batista over on The Ultimate Fighter. Then he goes out and fights Brett Martin, also loses. How'd he lose those two fights? By knockout. Josh Parisian comes into the UFC, loses his first fight against Parker Porter by decision. Well, both these guys have something in common. Old Parky Porty, able to get the win. So then Parisian goes out and
Parker fights... Porter's kind of okay, though, and I think we have to realize that.
Josh Parisian goes out and fights Roque Martinez and loses that fight, but wins that fight by split decision. Roque Martinez beat him in every round.
Okay. Ostensibly. You disagree with every decision.
And then Dontell Mays fights old Josh Parisian. And listen, the commentary around Dontell Mays all this time along was that this guy's a good wrestler and he's got judo in his back pocket. Never uses it. Used it against Josh Parisian. Finished him on the ground. Josh Parisian's three fights in the UFC, Dana White's Contender Series. Anybody big that he's fought has been poor except for, well, I guess, yeah, that Contender Series fight. Josh Parisian is the most unranked 2008 heavyweight I've ever seen in my life.
Okay.
Like, not even Heath Herring levels.
We, for the, a lot of people have, like, smartphones nowadays, right? And if you go back to, like, 2009, 2008, one of the first evolutions of a lot of it was the iPod Touch. I vividly remember having one. And if you go back to the golden age of apps, there was Angry Birds, there was Fruit Ninja. I don't know if people remember Simple Physics, but that was the best game ever. There was, yeah, like, it was seven mini games, and it was just like, hey, draw, like, basically the structure, and there's just these different tests, and we'll figure out if it can stand up to it or not. Alain Badeau's fighting style is like the skyscraper level on that. But if you just did the outside outline of a skyscraper and didn't fill it up with anything, if you just let it be there and like a 10-mile-an-hour gust of wind knocked it over, it didn't even get to like 170, 180, and you really had to test the structure. For Alain Badeau, there's not... I remember the Indianapolis Colts' defense when they had Peyton Manning was often described as a bend-but-not-break defense to where we're going to make sure that they don't put up 50. They might get 30, but we have Peyton Manning. He'll get 40.
Marvin Harrison, Reggie Wayne.
Exactly. The golden age of football, if you ask me. But that was their mindset. We might not be the best, but we'll be good enough to where we can outscore you. Alain Badeau's style is... bend a little bit and then immediately break. Because once he does face pressure, and especially offensive pressure from his opponent, I don't mean pressure like the moment getting to him. I just mean if he's pressured with striking or takedowns, he doesn't really know which one to defend. And that's a big problem.
What would he make of that Tovlo, like, pressure, do-do-do-do-do-do-do? He should walk out to that.
I think
people
should.
Like my dancey tunes out of my mouth. You think I should be a beatboxer?
I certainly don't.
Okay.
I hope I didn't ruin any future dreams. Just... for this fight, this is a weird one. I do agree. This is a Jeff Hardy, CM Punk, loser goes home. Because for Parisian, I think he has a better gas tank than Alain Badeau, if I'm being honest. I do think he's probably the steadier of these fighters. I gotta say something about them, Craig. Because for Badeau, I just don't know if he's going to be willing to move forward and engage in the pocket with Parisian. Parisian will get himself knocked out going for the win. Alain Badeau won't necessarily go for the win in the first place. And that's why I do slightly favor Josh Parisian. I know that's a weird way of saying this fight, but I would much prefer Josh Parisian's forward movement and defensive liabilities than Alain Badeau's just... I'm going to wing shots from my shoulders because he does have that weird upright style of boxing. Like, he's like Random Marcos. All of his punches don't come from the hip. They come from the shoulders. And normally you would think, hey, he's a fighter who keeps his hands up because of that. Nope, Chuck Testa. He keeps his hands by his shoulders, which is okay, but it still leaves an open target to the head and to the body. So I don't think either one of these guys are the highest level of mixed martial artists on planet Earth. So I have Josh Parisian, but if you want to convince me of an Alain Badeau pick, I'm all ears.
I've never picked Alain Badeau for anything, and we usually try our best to be, you know, complimentary of both sides. We pick a method of victory for both guys. I've never done that for Alain Badeau, and he's lost two fights in the UFC, and he lost another one that was overturned to a no contest. For Josh Parisian, Roque Martinez won the first round, busted up Josh Parisian's eye. The second round was close. The third round, Martinez won, and the judges scored it for Parisian, which nobody else in the world scored it for Parisian other than two of the three judges. So forward pressure for Parisian, but again, I think of him as a 2008-2010 heavyweight that's going to work to clinch, that's going to try and take you down. But Parisian doesn't even do that. Like, he doesn't take guys down and wear on them and land ground and pound. No, no, no. He's like, I don't know. Like, if you like Jared Vandera, the Mountain, you like Josh Parisian. Like, these guys that will box to clinch.
What an exclusive group that must be.
Like, guys, like, if you're going to come back and Teehee on this fight, this isn't the fight to Teehee on. We have a look at the odds. They're par right now. We're going to have a look at the fan vote. I don't care what it's at. Listen, it's going to be close. 58% Budo, 42% Parisian. Like, there's probably people out there in the crowd that are, you know, embarrassed that they went with Alain Budo or Josh Parisian, but they threw that vote out there.
Myself would be included in that crowd.
First round Budo versus Nascimento. If he fights Josh Parisian, he knocks him out. Like, he knocks him out, like, inside a round.
If a guy does the thing he's only done one time in his career and he never looks like that person, then maybe outside the UFC, beating guys who are 0-2 mean nothing to me. I'm sorry.
Alain Badeau goes out there like when he fought, and you guess it, I'm going to bring up this one. Dalcha Champ, where he gets cold-cocked and completely face-plants. Like, it's so hard to tell you who's going to win this fight. These guys are not very good.
This is why I really like boxing. You want to know why? There is a very clear path to becoming amazing at boxing. This is why amateurs in boxing is so important. Just let me finish this. In boxing, you have an amateur circuit, which eliminates power from the equation. You don't get credit for... You do get credits for knockouts, but for the most part, amateur boxing is you hit them and you don't get hit. You just work on your technique and you refine it and refine it and refine it. Then you go to the Olympics. You go against the other best people in the world at amateur boxing to where power doesn't matter very much. And then the judges just keep on tallying the punches and they tell you who wins. Alain Badeau is like if you never did any of that and only fought a bunch of guys who were 0-1. Like, for Alain Badeau, he's looked good against bad fighters, and he's never even looked competitive with okay fighters. For Josh Parisian, much of the same can be said, but he's at least kept it somewhat competitive with a few okay fighters, and that's why I have him as my pick. But again, you could tell me anything about this fight, and I would believe you.
If somebody goes out there in this comment section and says, well, Alain Badeau trains with Ciryl Gane, so Alain Badeau is going to win the fight.
So you can't defend takedowns?
You're the same person that said Deron Wynn trains with Habib, so Deron Wynn's going to beat Phil Haas. Listen, if you talk about boxing, the only thing that you have to do is move across the pond to Canada and then go down to the States with a limited amount of corners and knock out the American. I'm talking Bitterbiev. I mean, what a guy. What a guy. When I'm looking at this fight, I'll reluctantly go with Alain Badeau because I'm going to bet on the picture of what I want. But man, the bill of goods, it's bad. And I don't like either of these guys. And I've said some negative things against Badeau on this channel.
I don't like them. I don't know them.
I don't like either guy when it comes to their martial arts skills. I'm going with Francis Badeau to get a UFC win. But boy, I wouldn't do anything with this fight. Would you?
I've got Parisian.
We're split on the pick. It's a bad fight. Two good fights. Main event, co-main event. We're going to punch it up. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Couple of guys undefeated on this card are Umar Nurmagomedov, Shavkat Rakhmonov. You add the records up, it's 29-0, and 15 of those wins go to the Nomad, the former M1 Global welterweight champ, the reigning and then defending and then UFC fighter is Rakhmonov. Three fights inside the UFC, one over Alex Oliveira, one against Michelle Prazeris, which is a meme. I think it's a meme. It's a meme in my world. And then his last time out, he took on Carlson Harris, a very well-rounded fighter. He's tricky on the feet. He's great with his grappling. Shavkat went finish, finish, finish. And then he got a bonus his last time out. How wild is that? I mean, it's insane.
Okay, I said before the Carlson Harris fight that I think Shavkat Rakhmonov could beat Khamzat Chimaev. And a lot of people, including the man to my right, said I was ridiculous for saying that. Now, Khamzat had not fought Gilbert Burns yet, so we didn't really know what we know now. I'm feeling pretty good about that statement all of a sudden, though, because Shavkat Rakhmonov really is one of the most exciting prospects in the whole entire sport, and it is really nice that he's finally getting his due against a ranked opponent, but there really is a key in that three-fight win streak that you bring up. All three of the fighters he beat were amazing. Like, I know Prazeris was a little bit older in his career, but I would say the three wins he has in the UFC are over fairly good fighters for it being his first three fights. And I do think that those are three good opponents to get you ready for ranked opponents. Because Alex Oliveira, a rangy striker, you gotta get used to that. Michelle Prazeris, a much more compact wrestler, basically the exact opposite.
Not great at passing drug tests.
Not great at passing drug tests whatsoever. Not good at making weight. Really good at being, like, the strongest man ever at 155 to 170, though. I will give him that credit. And Carlson Harris, who definitely didn't have the fanfare behind him going into that fight, but I think the people who know how good of a fighter he is. Shavkat Rakhmonov wheel-kicked him and then ground and pounded him and sent him, to quote Luke Thomas, into the land of wind and ghosts. And that's the wild thing about Rakhmonov. When you look at his record 15-0, yes, that looks really nice, but then you look at the breakdown of his record and you figure out that, yes, he can get it done on the feet, he can get it done on the mat too, and against good grapplers, which is the wildest thing, because for how good Prazeris is, he's a wicked grappler. I never thought in a million years Shavkat would be able to submit a guy guy like him. He beat him by a rear naked choke in the second round.
Yeah, the craziest part about it for Rachmaninoff, because for Neil Magny, and we'll touch on it, he's been in the UFC since 2013, 19-7 record. He had a 7-fight win streak, capped off by 2 performance of the night bonuses, then took on Damian Maia on the undercard of a big card. Both cards, when he debuted,
94.
Ronda Rousey taking on a big time out in, who is it? Who
Liz
is it?
Carmouche?
Liz Carmouche. That was the first big time title fight. Wow, we. And then you look at it, UFC 190 was a fight against Damian Maia. And in that one, that was on the prelims, and Magny loses to Maia. But all of that said, Magny, tough guy, actual veteran, longtime UFC veteran. His craziest fight, I'd say, was a fight where he got knocked down twice against Hector Lombard, rallied and finished him. But all of this goes to say that Neil Magny recently, he's what, 4-1 in his last 5 fights, a loss to Michael Chiesa on like daytime television, because that was a weird Fight Island card that was on a Wednesday. But some really nice wins. Obviously, Robbie Lawler, great feather to have in your cap. But Neil Magny, very similar every time in timeout. Understands his length, uses his range well, good on the in-betweens, good with his grappling unless he's taking on like a really upper echelon grappler, good in a striking unless he's taking on like Santiago Ponzinibbio in a main event. But when it comes down to this fight, I look at Neil Magny as very steady, very similar fight in, fight out. Shavkat, similar, but he's made some gains here and there. And since he switched over to Sanford MMA, he's turned things up a little bit. His defensive striking has gained. He was a guy that he could use his jab, but he does stand kind of square when he walks guys down. And he is a right-hand dominant type of guy. He does fight from the orthodox stance, but he is square. He is there to be hit. Thiago Verjao was able to do it. A few other guys on the way up when he was with M1 Global could hit him, daze him. Shavkat would come back, work in some of his grappling, work in some of his striking, get the win. But Shavkat has accentuated kicks to all 3 levels. He's worked in his boxing a little bit more. He waits to download his opponent's game plan, which Neil Magny will do, so they could cancel out in certain circumstances. But I think this fight is going to be a lot of fun, and I think we're going to learn more about Shavkat Rachmaninoff this week.
Without a doubt, because that's, again, this is a big point of mine. At the upper echelon of MMA, I don't really care what your strengths are. Yes, they're great, but for the most part, once you get to that point, we all know what you're good at. It matters what your weaknesses are, because everybody's still well-rounded. They can take the fight anywheres. They're good to figure out where you're not strongest, and they're good to try to exploit that. Now, for Neil Magny, I mean this is a compliment, but he's almost consistent in the worst way possible, because, like you said, we do know what he's going to do. He's a good wrestler. He's a good striker. There's not any one part of his game that's very weak. But because there's no one area of his game that's all that strong either, we do know that the guys who are specialists can really give him trouble. You bring it up, Damian Maia on the mat. No, of course, Maya's going to give a lot of guys trouble.
RDA
too. Sweeps. He hit him with that leg kick, immediately got on top, submitted him. Neil Magny also struggles with guys who are pure strikers, and people might think that I'm hyping up Shavkat a little bit too much right now. Shavkat, I think, is as good of a striker as Santiago Ponzinibbio. At least as good as Ponzinibbio is at this stage of his career. And I know Ponzinibbio, before he got hurt so many times, was a different fighter than the guy we see now, but Shavkat at 27 really is that special kind of a fighter. They're not giving him Neil Magny in his 4th UFC fight because they think he's just going to be another guy, like an Alexander Hernandez, and they're just giving him a big shot. Like, Shavkat has looked great against good fighters at the UFC level. The thing I'm curious about, though, is where does he have the most confidence in this fight? Because we bring up, he is a good grappler, he is a good striker. I think Neil Magny's bread and butter is more his striking on the feet. I think he will try to get some volume, especially early on in this fight. I just don't think Neil Magny can avoid the big shot for 15 minutes. And that's the thing. If he does get hit and dazed, Shavkat can finish you with his strikes or with his submissions. And he is the type of fighter who can do it in an intelligent manner. We used to talk about Jeff Neal all the time, but how he throws straight shots. He's very technical when he gets a guy hurt. Shavkat's cut from that same cloth. The difference is, if you're hurt and go to your back, he can follow you down to the mat and cause even more damage.
And the trouble with that statement is, Jeff Neal's great at all of those things. And when he took on Neil Magny, Neil Magny mixed it up and he was able to land on the
feet. But
that's
the thing. Jeff Neal does not have the grappling aspect of his game that Shavkat does. Shavkat's like, if you had the striking of Jeff Neal, Santiago Ponzinibbio, and you added the grappling of almost like a Nick Lentz.
Yeah, it really is tricky. And for Rachmaninoff, he's one of those guys that he can even, and we haven't seen in the UFC, but he can even struggle with some of his own takedown defense, and he can use it as a little bit of a crutch to work some of his submissions, I guess, so to speak. But it is an odd factor that we've seen him kind of shore up, or it's been glorified, I guess, through the three finishes in the UFC. But it's one of those things. We'll see if Neil Magny actually does go for the takedowns and is successful with them as well.
I've been terrified to fight Rakhmonov. I know I sound like this big fanboy, but I'm not. It's just like, stylistically, this guy's a problem for a lot of people in the top 15. You bring it up. Straight shots in the feet. Very technical boxer. Has ridiculous kicks when he lets them go. And the big thing about Rakhmonov, too, is he sets up his power shots. How many times in MMA do we see guys just wing big punches and hope for the best? All the time in every single fight, Shavkat will work behind his jab, try to blind you with his jab, and then hit you with the big shot that'll really make the difference in the fight.
Yeah, it doesn't even have to be a big right hand. It could be a kick to the body when you start to bring your defenses up. It really does get tricky that way. And if you look at it for Neil Magny, last time he got a finish win was over, my God, like, he completely derailed his career. It was a Thundercat, Craig White. And White's gone on to lose five fights in a row, where Neil Magny's gone on to have a hell of a career. I'm not trying to laugh, but I do look at this one, Matt. I mean, Shavkat open to minus 275 favorite, minus 398 right now for Neil Magny, open to plus 235, plus 300. The guy has 28 UFC fights, and he's that big of an underdog against the undefeated Rakhmonov. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Sometimes fan vote goes hand in hand. So I do expect the fans to have Rakhmonov. I'm going to say over under 80% Rakhmonov. 82.5% Rakhmonov.
It's weird they'd switch it up for the 2.5%. I'll say above.
You're going to say above? It is. So 648 total votes. 90% Rakhmonov. 18% decision. 21% submission. 56% by knockout. Those percentages don't add up, but it is what it is. For the 10% that have Magny, 73% by decision, 13% by knockout. I think if Neil Magny wins, it's going to be a grimy decision. If he does win, obviously he was dropped in his last fight against Max Griffin. He won a split decision. He beat Jeff Neal, mixing in the wrestling, using his volume. If Rakhmonov can't figure out that distance, again, 3 inches in the difference is the reach, but Neil Magny's the guy that understands that reach advantage and his height. Some people don't, but Neil Magny, when you crowd him, can have issues. Now, again, I said he's good in the clinch. He's good up against the fence. But sometimes when you crowd him, he doesn't deal all that well with the uppercuts and the knees to the body. Rakhmonov's a guy training out of Sanford now that I think they're going to tune him up. A guy like Jason Jackson, perfect to train with, getting ready for a fight like this.
Here's the thing I'll say about Neil Magny's distance management. I'm going to zag a little bit. He's normally 7 inches taller than everyone he fights, so it's easy to fight tall when you're that much bigger than everyone at this division. Shavkat's 6'1". He's a big welterweight himself, so I don't think Neil Magny's going to have those traditional physical advantages that he normally has in the cage, and that's why I do think Rakhmonov can have success at his own kicking range, because his kicking range is going to be Neil Magny's jabbing range, and Neil Magny doesn't check leg kicks. Shavkat Rakhmonov can kick like a mule. So I just really think, stylistically, this is a tough fight for Neil Magny. It almost feels like Dana White doesn't want him in the rankings anymore. He's just sitting back being like, how can we get rid of Neil Magny? Because Magny, when he does have success against these guys coming up with the rankings, let's use some examples before we cut this video off. He beat Li Xingliang by closing the distance, using his clinch, getting into elbow range, smother the fire so it never has time to burn, and he did the exact same thing against Rocco Martin, too.
Rocco kind of came at him.
But he was doing a really good job at, instead of just trying to run away from Rocco and let him chase you, close that distance, get the clinch, start using your elbows. The problem is, every single situation that Neil Magny's going to find himself in this fight, Shavkat can damage him a lot, to where I don't think Neil can damage Shavkat.
Both of us going with Shavkat Rakhmonov to keep that shiny W going and keep it, making it 16-0 in his career. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. If you have Kazakhstan's Rakhmonov, if you have the Haitian sensation Neil Magny to go 20-7 in his overall UFC record. A great fight, a great main event coming up. Armin Zarukian, Mateusz Gamrot. What a fight. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend at lightweight, an absolute banger, a fight you should be excited about, and I'm so glad you could join us with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half your host and duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP, with me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen, on the respective socials, at Matt Allen FNP. And if we could have put together a fight, it probably would have been Zarukian versus Gamrot. The former KSW double champ is the man out of Poland. He was a champ at featherweight, he was a champ at lightweight. He had 6 total title fights over there, and 2 fights against Norman Park that were supposed to be title fights, but Norman didn't make the weight, and for Storm and Norman, amazing fights against Gamrot, tons and tons of damage, a lot of fun to watch. But you look at it for Gamrot, 20-1 with a no contest, the one loss to Guram Kutataladze. He lost by split decision. People have made arguments either way. I won't make them, but all of this to say...
Do it though, Craig, because I want to hear who you won.
I thought Guram won. Okay. But to look at it, Matt, for Gamrot, you look at the last three fights. He beat Scott Holtzman and looks amazing in that fight. Pretty well face plants him and then finishes up with a little bit of ground and pound. Finishes Jeremy Stevens by Kimura, which was to be expected because of how good he is at grappling. And then he beat Diego Fajeia because he hit him with a knee from behind to his rib. That, if you look at it, Diego goes to referee Jason Herzog and goes, "I'm done, I'm done." And Herzog goes to rush in, and Gamrot goes, "I'm not done." Grabs the neck, and then pulls him into the rear naked choke. But ultimately, it's a good finish win for Mateusz Gamrot. But if you look at it for Gamrot, he's kind of like a car crash striking over with KSW. He's refined it a little bit since he's gone to American Top Team. But his bread gets buttered with his grappling, and I'm going to go through it a little bit. ADCC European champion multiple times over, most recently in 2019. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, freestyle wrestling base is what he came into MMA with. Again, the six title fights. He's had grappling tournaments, wrestling tournaments all the time through, all the live long day. And for Gamrot, he is one of the trickier guys when it comes to his wrestling and grappling because you don't know where the shot's going to come from. It could be an ankle pick. It could be a single leg. It could be a double leg. As soon as Carlos Diego Fajeia, an accredited grappler, brings his hands up even a little bit, Gamrot jumped in on a double leg. Didn't have great top control in that fight, and that's one of those things with Gamrot. He'll go entry, entry, entry. But just to get those takedowns was amazing for him in that fight.
But we had seen it happen before against Fajeia. That is the thing. Like, Gregor Gillespie was able to consistently out-grapple him in their fight. I get it, but if we're going to prop up Gamrot to this point to where, oh my goodness, if he can out-grapple Fajeia, he can out-grapple anybody. We had seen it done before, and that's why I don't necessarily put a ton of stock into that. Fajeia's looked old as of late.
I did this for the fans. You folks out there are Armin Zarukian fans, and let's hear it from you out there in that comment section, because I know it's there. You look at his first fight in the UFC against Islam Makhachev, and it was a fight of the night. Two judges, 30-27 for Makhachev, 29-28 for Zarukian, the second round being the one there. But Zarukian flowed in the grappling, and he was the first person to convincingly take down Islam Makhachev. He had his back. He just continued to hold on to it. But Zarukian looked good in a loss, and he's looked amazing in the win streak since, and he looked great against Joel Alvarez.
And that's why when you were listing off all of Gamrot's like grappling awards and whatnot, in the back of my head I'm thinking, okay, we said all the same stuff about Joel Alvarez, and he's a really good grappler off his back. What did Armin Zarukian do to him? Took him down, hit him with some of those vicious ground and pound I've ever seen since, like, Curtis Blaydes fought Alistair Overeem. Opened up multiple cuts on his face to where you barely recognized who Alvarez was. So that's the thing. Like, that's the thing about Armin Zarukian. We've seen him grapple with other great grapplers, and at the peak of their powers, if you will, too. And that's why I do think Armin Zarukian should have the grappling edge in this fight. The real question is, what does Armin look like if he's not able to get this fight to the mat? Because for Gamrot, we talk about how, yes, he might be better at grappling than he is at striking. He's still a very good striker. I do worry about him against, like, the top five, because in this division, you have guys like Gaethje, Poirier, Oliveira, like, truly elite strikers in this division. But against unranked guys, and even guys in this like 15 to 10 range, I still think Gamrot can win a few rounds on the feet. But the thing about Gamrot is, at a certain point, I think he is going to have to go for a takedown of his own. And if you're going to initiate a scramble with a guy like Armin Zarukian, is that really going to be your best path to victory? Because I think Gamrot can grapple off his back a little bit with Zarukian to where he won't get immediately busted up and submitted like we've seen some guys in the past against Armin. But I don't think he can stay technique for technique with Armin. I do think he will be a bit of a step behind throughout this fight if we do find these two in long wrestling exchanges. And that'll be, again, where this fight gets very interesting. It's because if Gamrot can keep it on the feet, he should have success, but he is hittable himself, so maybe Armin can land a looping shot like we used to see Khabib do before he leveled up his striking. And for Zarukian, can he really make damage happen while he is in that top position? Because I think Gamrot's going to try to scramble a lot. He's a very active fighter himself, especially from that bottom position. But with Armin, it's just, I can't believe it until I've seen it. And I don't think I can believe that anybody in this division can convincingly out-grapple Armin Zarukian. It's just Gamrot himself, he's cut from the same cloth. He is a very good grappler. This fight's just so competitive no matter where it takes place that's why I'm excited for this fight. Neither guy is as well known as you probably think for them getting a UFC main event, even for a fight night. Like, this is a very high profile sport. Normally they give this to like a Misha Tate, a Holly Holm. Athletes might be past their prime, but hear me out. They're past their prime. They're not as good as these fighters are, but they have much bigger name recognition, and that's why they're given these opportunities. I just hope these guys make for a phenomenal fight, because there should be a lot of eyeballs on this, so hopefully both guys show the best versions of themselves.
354,000 Instagram followers for Zarukian to 302 for Gamrot, and when I focus on this one, Mateusz Gamrot is the more complete striker. Never thought I'd say that, but he is a funky southpaw. Now, Zarukian had success against a funky southpaw in his UFC debut, even though he lost the fight, and even though there were 30-27s in Islam Makhachev. Like, he's a funky southpaw, and you gotta watch for his strikes. For Gamrot, though, he'll mix in his kicks. He likes to throw a body kick. Could get you in trouble against a guy like Zarukian. Or the body kick's there because you're a southpaw fighting a guy who is an orthodox fighter in Zarukian. Now, what did Zarukian do when he fought Makhachev? He switched his stance and he fought from southpaw in a lot of that
Very
fight.
Impressive.
So he was able to work it in. Now, with Zarukian on the feet, yes, against Yagos, he looked really good. But he's not necessarily known as a boxer. I know he's only 25. I know he's leveled up in his boxing.
It's wild he's only 25, by the way.
But his big thing for Zarukian is his head kick. And I mean, his head kick is deadly from either stance. It's something that you have to watch out for. I think Gamrot's one of the few guys in this division, like Makhachev, that can flow through their grappling with Zarukian. To what extent? We'll find out this weekend. And I also thought, doing my tape study on this, watching the KSW fights, watching Mateusz Gamrot do his thing, 21 fights that didn't end in no contest, one that did, but for him, title fight experience, 6 fights, and then again, the 2 against Park that are weird, but he's getting ready for these 5-round fights. Go and watch his fight against Diego Fajeya. He's slowing down on the feet in the 2nd round when he's going to land some of his strikes, and I thought, wow, this guy's going to have a huge advantage there. He's grappling heavy in the 1st round. He's grappling heavy in the 2nd round. Yes, he wins the fight. Yes, he wins it by finish. But motherfucker, I worry about that when you're taking on a guy like Armin Zarukian.
I think that's a great point to bring up, too. And I think it's a great point to bring up how he has had past 5-round experience, but it still seems to be an issue.
Zarukian doesn't have 5-round experience. He's an MFP lightweight champ. Those fights were 3-round fights that he won by decision. He's never fought a 5-round fight. I don't necessarily worry about it.
He's a minus 45 diesel machine, though. This guy does not quit under any conditions. Like, that's the thing about Armin. Armin is like a Paulo Costa, even. Like, you can look at some guys, they don't have the 5-round experience, but you look at the way they're able to fight in 3-round fights, or even for 1 round, and you look at it and say, hey, if they can just tether it a little bit more, if they can just figure out their own Goldilocks zone, they will then have better cardio. I think that's a good point for Zarukian. He just knows what pace to fight at. That's a very important thing for any fighter to have in their first 5-round fight.
So I came into this one, I'll be completely honest with everybody. I was looking at the odds and I went, Mateusz Gamrot, championship experience, better, more well-rounded striker, good in the scrambles. I'm picking him to win this fight. I'm dead serious. I had Mateusz Gamrot. And then I started doing my tape study, and it started to chip away at my confidence in Mateusz Gamrot. And again, threw it out there in the YouTube community tab for you folks. And I know there's so... Armin Zarukian is one of those fighters where, like, there's fans, and they come out and they let it be known. So taping the fights tonight, we threw it out 7 hours ago. 70% of the fans going with Armin Zarukian, 30% with Mr. Gamrot for Bob Singh. Is Armin the greatest rep prospect? What I mean is he's so talented, but I feel he's still rough in bringing his whole MMA game together. I feel he could be great if he can mix in the stand-up with the wrestling, but he seems very rigid. We've got Hank Tura. I'm not doubting Zarukian MMA anymore. The one and only Gamrot with the upset. The Wretch saying, I don't think Gamrot has a chance. Daryl saying Gamrot under the Wretch. Travis saying, finally someone agrees with me. I think Gamrot's got this one. There's going to be a lot of fan confidence with Zarukian, I think, more so. People just heart and soul going with Gamrot than really able to pick apart, with Zarukian, not able to pick apart Gamrot's game plan. Hopefully we've done a decent enough job of that in this one, Matt. I think the odds, I mean, listen, you've got Zarukian as the favorite, open minus 140, minus 255, Gamrot open plus 120, plus 203. So if you see the value there in Gamrot, like I did before I really threw it all together, maybe you want to go with Gamrot. I've just been swayed by the research I've done towards Zarukian. In wanting to pick an underdog, I want Gamrot, but I have a hard time.
These guys are going to grapple at some point. They just are. Like Gamrot, it's in his DNA. He cannot just strike for 25 minutes. He can strike for 10 minutes. He can strike for five, but at a certain point, he is going to need his own grappling offensively to at least even switch up the pace of the fight. It's like a boxer who goes for clinches. Even if they're really going to the outside, you just want to give your opponent a different look at a certain point. And I do think that sort of the factory reset for Gamrot is going to be going for grappling, going to be going for grappling. I think Aram Mizrukian is one of the last guys you want to grapple with because he can stay a very similar fighter in that first round that he can in the third round. And I do think he'll be able to then extend himself to the fourth and the fifth. I think this will be a great fight, especially if Gamrot can keep it on the feet for a long time early on. Maybe we learn a lot more about Sarukian striking against an upper echelon guy like Gamrot that we just don't know so far. But I do like Armin for his ground and pound ability, for his scrambles, and for his cardio. I really do think those three things help set him apart from your other average kind of prospect. I was just so impressed by what he did to Joel Alvarez. Like, that was one of those performances where I thought he was good, don't get me wrong, but now I truly think he's great.
And it has to be said, this is, I get it, Sarukian's the fan favorite. I get he's the actual favorite. This is a big step up from Olivier Aubin-Mercier, Davi Hamoš, Joel Alvarez, from Christos Yagos. Like, Mateusz Gamrot has one friggin' loss on his record, champ from another organization, longtime champ, lots of title fights, and he's won three fights in a row by finish, the only loss being a close one to Guram Khatatladze. Same thing for Armin Sarukian. Comes in, fight of the night against Islam Makhachev, and it's only been, you know, up from there. And we know how good Sarukian is, and we know how good Guram is as well for being an unranked fighter in his own right. So Matt, both of us going with Armin Sarukian to get the win. It pains me to say it. It is such an amazing fight. Hopefully you enjoyed the videos here. If you don't, so be it. If you do, toss us a like. It helps out the channel. Subscribe if you haven't already. Question Mark Kicks coming up on Saturday. If there's any changes to the fights, we have the opportunity. We'll do it so on the show, but also we'll update you throughout the week here on the channel. So if anything happens, make sure you look out for that. You can find us at Fight Night Picks, Craig Allen FNP, Matt Allen FNP, Instagram, Twitter, doing the damn thing. Some great fights coming up, Matt. I know you're looking forward to a lot of the ones on this card, too.
This is a really great card. I know it might not have the most name value on it.
Real steel and sex appeal, not quite there?
It certainly isn't, but if you just want to talk about MMA skills and great fights, I think this card has something for everybody. Tefon Chukwuemeka versus Carlos Ahlberg is a weird fight, but it's a great fight. Halion Paiva versus Sergey Morozov is one that you're not going to want to miss kind of on the earlier portion of the card.
Mario Bautista, Brian Kelleher, one that I'm really looking forward to.
And hopefully in the co-main event, I've hyped it up enough. I really do think Shavkat's one of the top prospects in any division in the sport, so I think him against Neil Magny is a really fun fight. And again, for the main event, we can't say enough. These guys are both amazing prospects, if you will, because Gamrot I don't necessarily think is one, but Armin definitely fits the bill. Should be a great week of fights.
An amazing week of fights. We can't wait for it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.